Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I know I have made clear that guns were the weapon of choice for most of the boys discussed today. And indeed, guns bring permanence to hostility that would otherwise be transitory. I heard yesterday from Dr. Robert Fine at the Secret Service that's looking at this as well. They're looking at what have we all learned about high-stakes predictions that can be brought to these high schools. And he told me that one of the cases that he was studying was a case of two boys who were just arrested for conspiring to blow up their high school in 2003. They're talking about it today. They want to do it in 2003. Does anybody in this room believe that those boys are going to retain that will over 3.5 years? They will not. That is an example of how transitory these thoughts are. This year, three boys, and you correct me if it's wrong, James, is it three in America that have committed multiple shootings at school? The two at Littleton and the one at Atlanta? And then the...
This year,
right, and then the one in Canada. So this year, three boys, or four in North America, have committed a multiple shooting at school. Does anyone in this room believe that they are the only three boys who ever thought about it? Are they the only three boys who planned it? Are they the only three who got the guns, who built the bombs, who advanced on their plans? They are not. They are the only three who went forward. It takes a lot to go forward. It takes a lot of anger, a lot of hostility, a lot of fear, a lot of self-loathing, and a lot of courage. Courage isn't a word you hear applied to these boys very often, but they have it. Willing to go into combat with a SWAT team, willing to be killed doing it, that's courage. You change a few knobs on these boys, and we call them heroes, killing someone in Iraq. Interesting, isn't it, that Eric Harris didn't get accepted into the military? Eric Harris seems uniquely qualified to go overseas and kill people. If he's willing to do it here, you won't have a lot of trouble convincing him to do it with brown people in Iraq. So, though I've talked about weapons, and they happen to be the weapon of choice, guns are not the main issue today. The main issue today is that we can spot the inclination toward violence in those around our teenage boys and in the teenage boys who move in that direction.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, August 15th, 2019, so I have been told. This is our seventh study session on Gavin DeBecker's The Gift of Fear. We're picking up on chapter 13. I thought we may have been coming to the end of the program this week. Maybe next week we have a little bit more to go than I thought. I had to look at the audiobook a few times, but I think we have two, maybe even three more sessions remaining in the text, although we are close to the end. That said, I think last week we were in the middle of the shootings and the coverage, the aftermath of Ohio and Texas, I said, you know, wow, we're reading this book, and Mr. DeBecker has given many, many talks on shootings, school shootings, and mass shootings of all sorts. The audio segment that we started with, that was from 1999. They were talking, Mr. DeBecker, and a group of white speakers were invited specifically to talk about school violence, gun violence, things to do to prevent it. To know the warning signs, some of which he's talked about in the book. But I thought that was especially noteworthy, him saying specifically that the white shooters in Columbine, not able to join the military, it would seem that they would have been especially qualified to succeed there, to go overseas and shoot brown people, identifying them by their non-white color specifically. I thought that was extremely important. Won't add anything else. We'll get started. This is The Context of White Supremacy. Gavin DeBecker, The Gift of Fear. This is audio segment number one.
Chapter 13. Better to be wanted by the police than not to be wanted at all. The intercom in Rebecca Schaefer's apartment was broken. So when the buzzer rang on Sunday morning, she had to go down to the front door of the building to see who it was. It turned out to be a fan who'd first seen the young actress on her weekly TV show, My Sister Sam. She spoke to him briefly, and he left. A while later, the buzzer sounded again, and again she went down to see who was there. It was the same young man, but this time he was not her admirer. He was her murderer. He fired one shot into her chest. She screamed out, "Why? Why?" and fell to the floor. She was still alive as he stood there looking down at her. He could have asked someone in the building to call an ambulance, or he could have called one himself, but that would have defeated the whole purpose. Among individual crimes, assassination has the greatest impact on the American psyche. Bullets have demonstrably influenced most presidential elections in the past 40 years. A nation based on the concept that the majority chooses its leaders is entirely undermined when a minority, usually of one, undoes that choice with a gun. Whether the assassin's target is the mayor of LaPorte, Indiana, killed in his bed by an angry citizen, or the president of the United States, the system we live by also falls victim. Because of their disproportionate impact on our culture, identifying those people who will attack a public figure is our nation's highest-stakes behavioral prediction, one that affects everyone. At some point during our not-so-distant past, the conditions surrounding being famous changed. There's a part of that change that makes public life in Western society more challenging than it ever was before. It's the part that every prominent person, from the local politician to the beauty queen to the radio talk show host to the internationally known media figure, must consider at some time. With fame, there are hassles that some say come with the territory. But where did anyone sign on to the idea that if you do very well, you will be at risk of being killed for it? To answer that, we must go back to the infancy of the media age. Performers, politicians, and sports figures have long been admired and even loved. But that love used to be contained and distant, relegated to a part of the mind and heart reserved for people one didn't know personally. It was, emotionally speaking, a one-way street, because feelings could be displayed to the public figure only as part of an acceptable function, like voting, sending letters, or seeing a show. Except for applauding louder or longer than others, members of an audience didn't seek to make themselves known personally to performers. Before the 1940s, if one woman in an audience stood up and shrieked at the top of her lungs throughout an entire show, she'd have been carted off to an asylum. By the mid-40s, however, entire audiences behaved like that, screaming, tearing at their clothes and hair, leaving their seats to board the stage. On December 30th, 1942, while Frank Sinatra sang at the Paramount Theater in New York, the behavior of the audience changed. and a part of our relationship to well-known people changed forever. Psychiatrists and psychologists of the day struggled to explain the phenomenon. They recalled medieval dance crazes, spoke of mass frustrated love, and mass hypnosis. Though none of these theories explained what happened, the media age did bring a type of mass hypnosis into American life. It affects all of us to some degree, and some of us to a great degree. Before the advent of mass media, a young girl might have admired a performer from afar, and it would have been acceptable to have a passing crush. It would not have been acceptable if she pursued the performer to his home, or if she had to be restrained by police. It would not have been acceptable to skip school in order to wait for hours outside a hotel and then try to tear pieces of clothing from the passing star. Yet that unhealthy behavior became normal in the Sinatra days. In fact, audience behavior that surprised everyone in 1942 was expected 2 years later when Sinatra appeared again at the Paramount Theater. This time, 30,000 screaming bobby-soxed fans were joined by a troop of reporters. Expecting a commotion, 450 police officers were assigned to that one theater, and it appeared that society had learned to deal with this phenomenon. It had not. During the engagement, an 18-year-old named Alexander Ivanovich Dorogokupets stood up in the theater and threw an egg that hit Sinatra in the face. The show stopped, and for a moment, a brief moment, Sinatra was not the star. Now it was Dorogokupets, mobbed by audience members, and Dorogokupets who had to be escorted out by police. Society had not learned to deal with this, and still hasn't. Dorogokupets told police, "I vowed to put an end to this monotony of 2 years of consecutive swooning. It felt good." Saddled with the least American of names, he had tried to make one for himself in the most American way. And but for his choice of a weapon, he would probably be as famous today as Frank Sinatra. Elements in society were pioneering the skills of manipulating emotion and behavior in ways that had never been possible before, electronic ways. The media were institutionalizing idolatry. Around that time, the world met a teenager named Elizabeth Taylor, who began an excursion through public life that defines the celebrity idol as we know it today. A lesser-known teenager of the 40s, named Ruth Steinhagen, would define the anti-idol as we know it today. Ruth particularly liked a ball player named Eddie Waitkus. He was more exclusively hers than Frank Sinatra, who belonged to everyone. Even though they'd never met, Ruth devoted her life to Eddie. He was of Lithuanian descent, so she tried to learn that language. He was number 36 on the Chicago Cubs, so she became obsessed with that number, buying every record she could find that was produced in 1936. She collected press clippings about Eddie, slept with his picture under her pillow, attended every game she could, and sent him letter after letter, even though he never responded. At dinner each evening, Ruth arranged the chairs so that there was an empty one facing hers. She told her sister, "Eddie is in that chair." Many of Ruth's friends had crushes on baseball players, and while her parents were glad at first that she too had an idol, they became concerned about her behavior. They took her to two psychiatrists, and her mother was glad to hear them report that nothing was wrong with her, except that she should forget about Waitkus. Which is a little like saying nothing was wrong with John Hinckley, except that he should forget about Jodie Foster. Of course, Ruth did not forget about Waitkus, even for a moment, and when he was traded to the Philadelphia Phillies, she stated that she could not live if he moved away from Chicago. She began to discuss suicide with one of her girlfriends, and then set out to buy a gun. She wanted a pistol. But because a permit was required, she went to a pawn shop and bought a rifle instead. In the first week of June 1949, Ruth had decided on something better than suicide. She told her friend Joyce to watch for the fireworks on Tuesday, the day she checked into the Edgewater Beach Hotel in Chicago, knowing from the Phillies' schedule that Eddie would be staying there. She brought along a suitcase filled with Eddie memorabilia, including the ticket stubs from 50 games she'd attended. She also brought the rifle. In her room, Ruth wrote a letter to her parents. "I hope you understand things. I love you. Things will work out for the best." But crumpled it up and threw it in the trash. She then wrote a note to Eddie. "Mr. Waitkus, we're not acquainted, but I have something of importance to speak to you about. I think it would be to your advantage to let me explain it to you. As I'm leaving the hotel the day after tomorrow, I'd appreciate it greatly if you could see me as soon as possible. My name is Ruth Ann Burns, and I'm in room 1297A. I realize this is a little out of the ordinary, but as I said, it's rather important. Please come soon. I won't take up much of your time. I promise." Ruth tipped a bellman $3 to deliver the note. On reading it, Eddie thought she was probably just another baseball Annie, what we today call a groupie, and he agreed to visit her. Ruth put a knife in her skirt pocket, intending to stab Eddie in the heart as he entered her room. But he hurried past her, sat down in a chair, and asked, "So, what's all this about?"
"Wait a minute. I have a surprise for you," Ruth said, and then went to the closet and took out the rifle. "For 2 years you have been bothering me, and now you are going to die."
Ruth fired one shot into Eddie's chest. It punctured a lung and lodged just under his heart. Waitkus survived and even returned to professional sports. I found an old baseball card of his. Under the heading, "My Greatest Thrill in Baseball," it reads, "In 1949 I was shot by a deranged girl." The things Ruth said and did after the shooting were extraordinary in 1949, but no longer. She explained to police,
"I liked him a great deal and knew I could never have him, and if I couldn't have him, neither could anybody else. I've always wanted to be in the limelight. I wanted attention and publicity for once. My dreams have come true."
Ruth was eloquently expressing a sentiment all too familiar to modern-day Americans. In describing the aftermath of the shooting, she said,
"Nobody came out of their rooms. You would think they would all come rushing out. I got mad. I kept telling them I shot Eddie Waitkus. But they didn't know who Eddie Waitkus was. After that, the police came, but I was burning because nobody was coming out of those other rooms. Nobody seemed to want me much. I could have walked right out of that place and nobody would have come after me."
At 19 years old, Ruth felt it was better to be wanted by the police than not to be wanted at all. About 20 years later, a young woman named Valerie Solanas apparently felt the same way. An aspiring actress and writer, Solanas carried a gun into the headquarters of Andy Warhol and shot the famous artist. Soon after, Solanas walked up to a cop in Times Square and said, "The police are looking for me." She added proudly, "They want me." It was Andy Warhol who gave us the quote that is itself an icon of the media age. "In the future, everyone will be world famous for 15 minutes." Ironically, Valerie Solanas got her 15 minutes at Warhol's expense. She got another 90 minutes last year, when an entire film was made about her life. The Solanas attack occurred in 1968, and we were already jaded. But back when Ruth Steinhagen shot Eddie Waitkus, this kind of thing was nothing short of remarkable. When Ruth told her mother that she intended to get a gun and shoot Eddie Waitkus, her mother replied,
"You can't do that. Women don't do those things."
Mrs. Steinhagen would be proved wrong by Ruth, and by Valerie Solanas, and more recently by Squeaky Frome and Sarah Jane Moore, both of whom attempted to kill President Gerald Ford. Due to Ruth's choice of target, hers was not a shot heard round the world, though it did make her the first in a long line of media-age public figure stalkers and attackers. Some famous, many others not famous. Experts decided Ruth was insane, and she was committed to a mental facility,
3 years later, experts decided she had regained her sanity and she was freed. Still alive today, Ruth Steinhagen is the senior member of a uniquely American minority. It's not that other nations haven't had their share of assassination, but killings rooted in some idealistic or political expediency are a far cry from shooting a stranger just to get attention and publicity for once. There is also the uniquely American choice of targets. In the 30s and 40s, baseball players and statesmen were the most prominent and adored idols. By the time Joe DiMaggio married Marilyn Monroe, the torch of idolatry had been passed from sports to entertainment. 26 years later, an actor became president, and a media addict, John Hinckley, shot him, claiming an obsession with a film actress, Jodie Foster. After a long courtship, the marriage between violence and entertainment was consummated. Idolizing heroes and falling for their seductive appeal is normal in America. But what is a mild drug to most is a poison for some people. To learn more about that poison, I sought a meeting with an unlikely expert in the field, Robert Bardo, the man who killed Rebecca Schaefer. To visit him, I had to pass through two metal detectors and follow a prison escort down a series of long green corridors, each ending at a locked steel gate that, after careful scrutiny, a guard would let us through. Finally, I was shown into a small, concrete cell with two benches anchored to the floor. My escort said he'd be back soon, then closed and locked the cell door. Even with the certainty that one will be let out, being locked in a prison cell is like being locked in a prison cell. It feels awful. Waiting for Bardo, I thought of Robert Ressler, the FBI agent who'd spent much of his career at the Behavioral Sciences Unit studying and interviewing America's most prolific killers. Sitting in the cell reminded me of Ressler's final prison meeting with Edmund Kemper, a man who'd brutally killed 10 people, several of whom he had decapitated. Kemper was literally a giant, 6'9" tall and more than 300 pounds. At the end of a 4-hour interview, Ressler pressed the call button for the guard to come and get him out. Some time went by, but no guard. About 15 minutes later, he pressed the button again, and then again, still no guard. Kemper must have intuitively detected Ressler's concern, because on the tape of their interview he can be heard to say, "Relax, they're changing shifts, feeding the guys in the secure areas. Might be 15-20 minutes before they come and get you." After a thoughtful pause, Kemper added, "If I went apeshit in here, you'd be in a lot of trouble. I could screw your head off and place it on the table to greet the guard." Kemper was correct. Against his terrific size advantage and experience at killing, Ressler didn't stand a chance. Kemper, who had endured a long abstinence from his compulsive habit of murder, now had a live one, a famous FBI agent. Ressler warned the killer that he'd be in big trouble if he murdered a federal official. But Kemper, already serving 7 life terms, scoffed. "What would they do? Cut off my TV privileges?" There followed a 30-minute contest of fear and courage, with Ressler using his impressive behavioral insight to keep Kemper off balance. At one point in their high-stakes debate, Kemper acknowledged that if he killed Ressler, he would have to spend some time in the hole. But he added that it would be a small price to pay for the prestige of offing an FBI agent. One of Ressler's several gambits? "You don't seriously think I'd come in here without some way to defend myself, do you?" Kemper knew better. "They don't let anybody bring guns in here." That was true, but Ressler suggested that FBI agents had special privileges and that a gun might not be the only weapon available to him. Kemper didn't bite. "What have you got, a poison pen?" So it went, until guards arrived, thankfully before Kemper put his ruminations into action. As Kemper was walked out, he put one of his enormous hands on Ressler's shoulder. "You know I was just kidding, don't you?" But Kemper wasn't just kidding. He was feeding on a favorite delicacy of serial killers, human fear. The murderer, who soon joined me in the cell, had been after different rewards, attention and fame. With a young man's light stubble from a few days of not shaving and his prematurely receding hair a mess, Robert Bardo was not menacing like Kemper. In fact, he was the image of an awkward teenager. In another life, and in his previous life, he'd have been the guy dressed in a white apron sweeping the floor in the back of a drive-through restaurant. Robert Bardo was, as he put it, a geek. Because I'd studied him extensively when I consulted on his prosecution, meeting Bardo was like meeting a character from a book I'd read. I knew most of the lines he might speak, but the young man in front of me was a far more human incarnation than court transcripts or psychiatric reports could ever conjure. More human, perhaps, than I wanted him to be. The power he discharged in one terrible second on the steps of Rebecca Schaefer's apartment wasn't in that cell with us. He didn't have the confidence to intimidate anyone, nor did he have those dead, cold, murderer's eyes that intimidate all on their own. In fact, he was reluctant to even look at me. We both knew what a murderous thing he'd done, and he knew very well from the trial exactly how I felt about it. Bardo had been asked a great many questions since the killing, and he was used to that, so I decided to let him speak first, to follow rather than lead him. As it turned out, that took a lot of patience. For about 15 minutes, we just sat there, him with his head down, me counting on the idea that he wouldn't be able to pass up the attention I was withholding. The otherwise quiet cell was occasionally filled with the clang of some distant gate being slammed. Noise is one of the few things that roams freely in a prison. The concrete walls that keep out so much carry it into every corner. Bardo finally looked up at me and studied my face intently. "Arthur Jackson asked me to give you a message." Jackson was the obsessed stalker who had brutally stabbed actress Teresa Saldana. After I testified against Jackson in court, he condemned me to burn in hell. "He wants you to meet with him, too." "Not today," I replied. "Then why do you want to talk to me?" "Because you have something to contribute," I answered. "I'd want to help other people avoid what happened to Rebecca," he said. That choice of words implied some distance from his crime, which I didn't want to grant him. "Nothing just happened to Rebecca. You make it seem as if she had an accident." "No, no, I killed her, I shot her, and I want to help others not get killed by someone like me." "That sounds like you think there's someone else like you." He seemed surprised that it wasn't obvious. "There is. I mean, there are many people like me." He was quiet for a long while before he continued. "I'm not a monster. On television, they always want to portray me as someone frightening." I looked at him and nodded. We'd been together for nearly a half hour, and I hadn't asked him a single question. "I was someone frightening, of course, but I'm not now. That video of me telling how I shot Rebecca makes me look like the worst assassin of all, and I'm not the worst." He was concerned about his public image, about how he stacked up against his peers. Like nearly all modern-day assassins, Bardo had studied those who came before him. After Mark Chapman went to prison for killing John Lennon, Bardo wrote to him and asked why he had done it. Chapman, the famous assassin, and Bardo, the apprentice, had a brief correspondence. "If he had told me not to do my crime," Bardo said, "that would not have overridden my emotions. Emotions are the key. Out-of-balance emotions. Emotionally healthy people do not harm others." Bardo had also studied everything he could find on the Arthur Jackson case. Jackson had hired a private detective to locate his victim. So Bardo did too. Jackson used a knife. So on one of his earlier trips to kill Schaefer, Bardo brought one along. Jackson traveled thousands of miles in pursuit of his target, sometimes in a crisscross fashion, as do nearly all assassins, and Bardo did too. They started off a continent apart, but ended up living in the same building. In a videotaped interview done by the defense months before Bardo knew I was working on the case, he revealed the extent of his research into public figure attack. Describing the lack of security he had encountered around Rebecca Schaefer, he said, "It's not like she had Gavin DeBecker or anything." Now, in offering me advice, Bardo hoped to distinguish himself from other assassins. He would become, he thought, the anti-assassin, helping famous people avoid danger. Of course, he was now famous himself, a fact that carried him to an almost too ironic comment on public life. "All the fame that I have achieved from this results in me getting death threats and harassment. The media says things about me that aren't even true. I have no control over them invading my privacy, bringing up my case over and over again on TV so they can make money off it. They portray me in ways I never saw myself." He didn't like reporters calling him a loner, but the description was accurate. Bardo had no friends and had never even kissed a girl romantically. Almost certainly, he never will. A lack of healthy intimacy is a common feature of many assassins. John Hinckley didn't ever attain a developed romantic relationship, nor did Arthur Jackson, nor did Arthur Bremer, who shot presidential candidate George Wallace. Bremer was a virgin who sought to change that in the weeks before his crime. Knowing he would soon be dead or imprisoned for life, he hired a prostitute, but their sexual encounter ended awkwardly. In his diary, he wrote, "Though I'm still a virgin, I'm thankful to Alga for giving me a peek at what it's like." Bizarre though it may seem, the greatest intimacy most assassins attain is with those they attack. Through stalking, they come to know their victims more closely than they know others in their lives, and through shooting them, they become partners of sorts. Bremer's diary shows increasing intimacy with his first victim of choice, President Richard Nixon. As he stalked the president from state to state, the diary references move from the president to he to Nixon to Nixie and ultimately to Nixie boy. Those who attack with knives have even more intimacy. As is disturbingly described in multiple murderer Jack Henry Abbott's book, In the Belly of the Beast. Of one of his murder victims, he wrote, "You can feel his life trembling through the knife in your hand. It almost overcomes you, the gentleness of the feeling at the center of a coarse act of murder." Bardo's coarse act of murder was, with the saddest irony, inflicted on the only girl who ever gave him any positive attention. Rebecca Schaefer had sent a kind reply to one of his letters. Bardo. It was a personal postcard where she wrote, "Robert, Dash, your letter was the nicest, most real letter I ever received." She underlined real. She wrote, "Please take care," and drew a heart sign, and then Rebecca. That's what propelled me to want to get some more answers from her. So what advice would you offer other famous people? Be careful about what you write. If you do answer fan mail, don't let it be so overglowing. That's not the way to be with a fan, because it makes it seem like they're the only one. And that's how I felt. I felt I was the only one. Like other assassins, Bardo had stalked several famous people, including a client of mine whom he decided was too inaccessible. He gave up on her and switched his attention to Rebecca Schaefer. For assassins, it's the act and not the target. The destination, not the journey, that matters. Because targets are interchangeable, I asked Bardo how the security precautions taken by some public figures affected his choice. He said, "If I read in an article that they have security and they have bodyguards, it makes you look at that celebrity different and makes a person like me stand back. It kind of stands against this hope of a romantic relationship." Though Bardo's defense tried to sell the idea that he expected a romantic relationship with Rebecca Schaefer, he never really did. Bardo expected exactly what he got, an unenthusiastic reception and ultimately a rejection. He used that rejection as an excuse to do what he had long wanted to do, release his terrible anger against women, against his family, and against the rest of us. Of course, to care about being rejected by a total stranger, one must first come to care about that stranger. Bardo did this by obsessing on each of his various targets. Even today in prison, he's still doing it, focusing intently on two women. One is a singer, and the other is someone who was not famous when he first heard of her, but is very famous now. Marcia Clark, the prosecutor who sent him to prison for life. In a letter Bardo wrote to me, he explained, "Twice, the Daily Journal has profiled Marcia Clark. I learned a lot. Turn to page 2 to give you an idea." Page 2 was a lengthy list of personal facts about Marcia Clark and her family. It's a convoluted irony of the media age that Marcia Clark prosecuted a regular citizen who stalked and killed a famous person, then prosecuted a famous person, O.J. Simpson, who stalked and killed a regular citizen, then became famous herself, and is now the focus of a stalker. Media age assassins are not unlike another uniquely American icon, the daredevil. If you understand Evel Knievel, you can understand Robert Bardo. Like those of a daredevil, all of an assassin's worth and accomplishment derive from one act, one moment. This is also true for most heroes, but assassins and daredevils are not people who rise courageously to meet some emergency. The assassin and the daredevil create their own emergencies. The daredevil fantasizes about the glory of accomplishing his stunt, the fame that waits for him on the other side of the canyon. The media have portrayed the daredevil as a courageous hero. But what if someone got the motorcycle, painted it special, got the colorful leather pants and jacket, got the ramps, notified the press, got all set up at the canyon, and then didn't do it? Suddenly, he's not cool and special. He's pathetic. Now he's a guy whose silly name and goofy accessories add up to geek, not hero. The whole thing loses its luster if he doesn't do it. Arthur Bremer wrote, "I want a big shot and not a little fat noise. I am tired of writing about it, about what I was going to do, about what I failed to do, about what I failed to do again and again. It bothers me that there are about 30 guys in prison now who threatened the prez, and we never heard a thing about them." Assassins, you see, don't fear they're going to jail. They fear they are going to fail, and Bardo was no different. He had gotten all the components together. He had studied other assassins, he had researched his target, made his plan, gotten the gun, written the letters to be found after the attack. But like the daredevil, he was just a guy who worked at Jack in the Box until he made that jump, until the wheels left the ground, until he killed someone famous. Everything that goes with fame was waiting for him on the other side of the canyon where, in his words, he'd finally be a peer with celebrities. When he found Rebecca Schaefer and was face to face with her, he had all the credentials of an assassin, but he couldn't pick up his prize until he shot her. Since he was 14 years old, he had known what he wanted to be when he grew up, and he got there on the steps of Rebecca Schaefer's apartment building. Robert Bardo was a career assassin, a killer for whom the victim was secondary to the act. Some people put years into their heroic accomplishments. Assassins do not. While stalking Richard Nixon, Bremer wrote, "I'm as important as the start of World War I. I just need the little opening and a second of time." Such narcissism is a central feature of every assassin. And like many of their characteristics, it's in us all to some degree. In his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Denial of Death, Ernest Becker observes that narcissism is universal. Becker says every child's whole organism shouts the claim of his natural narcissism. It is too all-absorbing and relentless to be an aberration. It expresses the heart of the creature, the desire to stand out, to be the one in creation. Becker says we all look for heroics in our lives, adding that in some people, it is a screaming for glory, as uncritical and reflexive as the howling of a dog. But the howls for glory of assassins had been unanswered in their mundane pre-attack lives. The assassin might be weird or unusual, but we can't say we don't understand his motives, his goal. He wants what Americans want, recognition, and he wants what all people want, significance. People who don't get that feeling in childhood seek ways to get it in adulthood. It's as if they've been malnourished for a lifetime and seek to fix it with one huge meal. The same search for significance is part of the motivation for the young gang member who kills because violence is the fastest way to get identity. Murderer Jack Henry Abbott describes the involuntary pride and exhilaration all convicts feel when they are chained up hand and foot like dangerous animals. The world has focused on us for a moment. We are somebody capable of threatening the world. Ernest Becker writes, "The urge to heroism is natural, and to admit it, honest. For everyone to admit it would probably release such pent-up force as to be devastating to society." Well, Bremer, Hinckley, and Bardo all admitted it, with devastating results. Each first aspired to make it in Hollywood, but gave that up for a faster, easier route to identity. They knew that with a single act of fraudulent heroism, with one single shot, they could be forever linked to their famous targets. Like all endeavors, assassination is reached by a certain protocol, certain hoops one jumps through. Many of these are detectable, observable hoops that leave a trail we can follow. Assassins teach each other, each learning something from the ones before. When I worked on the Bardo case, I was struck by the fact that he did so many things that Hinckley had done before him. The two young men had early life experiences with some similarities, and that's no surprise. But the similarities of the choices they made later are nothing short of remarkable. For example, Hinckley knew that Mark Chapman had brought along a copy of Catcher in the Rye on his trip to murder John Lennon, so he brought one with him on his trip to shoot President Reagan. Bardo brought the same book along when he killed Rebecca Schaefer, later telling me he read it to find out how it made Chapman kill John Lennon. Look at this list of things that John Hinckley did before shooting President Reagan. Wrote letters to an actress. Wrote songs. Took a job in a restaurant. Read Catcher in the Rye. Crisscrossed the country. Stalked public figures other than his final target. Traveled to Hollywood. Kept a diary. Studied other assassins. Visited the Dakota Building in New York City to see the place where John Lennon was murdered. Considered an attention-getting suicide. Sold off his possessions. Wrote letters to be found after the attack, took a bus to the attack location, stalked his final target at more than one site before the attack, brought along Catcher in the Rye, didn't shoot at the first opportunity, left the scene after the first encounter, waited about a half hour, and then shot his target. Amazingly, Bardo also did every one of the things on this list. There are more than 30 striking similarities in the behavior of the two men. The predictability of pre-attack behaviors of assassins was confirmed by the work of Park Dietz, the psychiatrist and sociologist who first came to national attention as the lead prosecution expert in the Hinckley case. In 1982, when I was on the President's Advisory Board at the Department of Justice, I proposed a research project to study people who threaten and stalk public figures. Dietz was the expert we chose to run the project. From this and his other pioneering work, he assembled 10 behaviors common to modern assassins. Nearly every one of them, 1, displayed some mental disorder, 2, researched the target or victim, 3, created a diary, journal, or record, 4, obtained a weapon, 5, communicated inappropriately with some public figure, though not necessarily the one attacked, 6. Displayed an exaggerated idea of self, grandiosity, narcissism. 7. Exhibited random travel. 8. Identified with a stalker or assassin. 9. Had the ability to circumvent ordinary security. 10. Made repeated approaches to some public figure. In protecting public figures, my office focuses on those who might try to kill clients, of course, but also those who might harm clients in other ways, such as through harassment or stalking. In evaluating cases, we consider 150 pre-incident indicators beyond those covered above. If we had to choose just one pin we'd want to be aware of above all others, it would be the one we call ability belief. This is a person's belief that he can accomplish a public figure attack. Without it, he cannot. In fact, to do anything, each of us must first believe on some level that we can do it. Accordingly, society's highest stakes question might be, do you believe you can succeed at shooting the president? Would-be assassins won't always answer this question truthfully, of course, nor will society always get the opportunity to ask it. But to the degree it can be measured, ability belief is the preeminent pre-incident indicator for assassination. If the truthful answer is no, what with all those Secret Service agents and special arrangements, I couldn't get within a mile of the guy. The person cannot shoot the president. Of course, this isn't a permanently reliable predictor, because ability belief can be influenced and changed. If, for example, I believe I could not possibly dive into the ocean from a 200-foot-high cliff, then I cannot. But a coach might influence my belief. Encouragement, teaching of skills that are part of the dive, taking of lesser dives, first from 20 feet, then 30, then 50, would all act to change my ability belief. No single influence is more powerful than social proof. Seeing someone else succeed at the thing you might have initially believed you could not do. Seeing a diver propel himself off an Acapulco cliff, sail down into the Pacific, and then emerge safely dramatically influences my belief that it can be done and that I could do it. Similarly, the enormous media attention showered on those who attack public figures bolsters ability belief in others. It says, you see, it can be done. Little wonder that in the period following a widely publicized attack, the risk of other attacks goes up dramatically. It is precisely because one encourages another that public figure attacks cluster. President Ford, 2 within 2 weeks. President Clinton, 2 within 6 weeks. Society appears to be promoting two very different messages. One, it is nearly impossible to successfully attack a public figure, and if you do it and survive, you will be a pariah, despised, reviled, and forgotten. Two, it is very easy to successfully attack a public figure, and if you do it, you'll not only survive, but you'll be the center of international attention. Since we're discussing what amounts to a form of advertising, information following a public figure attack could be presented quite differently than it is now. Law enforcement personnel speaking with the press about a criminal who has been apprehended have tended to describe the arrest in terms of their victory over a dangerous, powerful, well-armed, and clever adversary. Investigators found 3 .45-caliber handguns and more than 200 rounds of ammunition in his hotel room. Since the perpetrator is a skilled marksman, it was touch and go when we stormed the building. This attaches to the criminal a kind of persona doubtless attractive to many who might consider undertaking a similar crime. I've recommended a different approach on my cases, one that casts the offender in a far less glamorous light. Imagine this press conference following the arrest of a person who is planning an assassination. Would you describe the man as a loner? Federal agent. More of a loser, actually. Did he put up any resistance when taken into custody? No, we found him hiding in the bathroom in the clothes hamper. Could he have succeeded in the assassination? I doubt it very much. He's never succeeded at anything else. Ideally, the agent would always switch the focus to the people and special methods that act in opposition to assassins, keeping the focus off the criminal. Federal agent, I want to commend the 8-man team of special agents whose investigative work and application of new technologies made the apprehension possible so rapidly. I propose that we don't show the bullets on the bureau in the seedy hotel room. Show instead the dirty underwear and socks on the bathroom floor. I propose that we don't arrange photo opportunities that show the offender being escorted by 10 federal agents from a helicopter to a motorcade of waiting cars. Show him instead in a mangy T-shirt, handcuffed to a pipe in some gloomy corridor, watched by one guard, and a woman at that. Not many identity-seeking would-be assassins would see those images and say, "Yeah, that's the life for me." Conversely, guarded by federal agents, just like the president, whisked into waiting helicopters, just like the president, his childhood home shown on TV, just like the president, the type of gun he owned fired on the news by munitions experts extolling its killing power, the plans he made described as meticulous. These presentations promote the glorious aspects of assassination and other media crimes. Getting caught for some awful violence should be the start of oblivion, not the biggest day of one's life. But it was the biggest day in the life of accused Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh, who was paraded in front of the waiting press surrounded by FBI agents, rushed to a motorcade, and then whisked away in a two-helicopter armada. We saw this even more with accused Unabomber Ted Kaczynski, whose close-up appeared on the covers of Time, U.S. News and World Report, and Newsweek twice. The cover text of all three described Kaczynski as a genius. Reporters usually refer to assassins with triple names, like Mark David Chapman, Lee Harvey Oswald, Arthur Richard Jackson. One might come to believe that assassins actually used these pretentious triple names in their pre-attack lives. They didn't. They were Mark, Lee, and Arthur. I propose promoting the least glamorous incarnation of their names. Call a criminal Ted Smith instead of Theodore Bryant Smith. Better still, find some nickname used in his pre-attack life. Federal agent. His name is Theodore Smith, but he was known as Chubby Ted. Our culture presents many role models, but few get as much hoopla and glory as the assassin. Those who have succeeded, and even some of those who failed, are among the most famous people in American lore. John Wilkes Booth survives history with more fame than all but a few other Americans of his time. The tragically symbiotic relationship between assassins and television news is understandable. Assassins give great video, very visual, very dramatic. Assassins will not sue you, no matter what you say about them, and they provide the story feature most desired by news producers, extendability. There will be more information, more interviews with neighbors and experts, more pictures from the high school yearbook. There will be a trial with the flavor of a horse race between lawyers, made famous just for the occasion, and there will be the drama of waiting for the verdict. Best of all, there will be that video of the attack, again and again. The problem, however, is that that video may be a commercial for assassination, as surely as Procter and Gamble ever pushed toothpaste. The approach of television news pushes public figure attack. Way back in 1911, criminologist Arthur MacDonald wrote, "The most dangerous criminals are the assassins of rulers." He suggested that newspapers, magazines, and authors of books cease to publish the names of criminals. If this not be done voluntarily, let it be made a misdemeanor to do so. This would lessen the hope for glory, renown, or notoriety, which is a great incentive to such crimes. MacDonald would be disappointed to see that media age assassins end up with virtual network shows, but he would not be surprised. After all, the early morning mist of mass media hype was already thick, even in his day. In 1912, a man named John Schrank attempted to kill Theodore Roosevelt. While he was in jail, his bail was abruptly raised because motion picture men had planned to pay it and secure his release long enough to restage the assassination attempt for newsreels. Objecting to the movie, the prosecutor told the court he was concerned about the demoralizing effect such a picture film would have. It would tend to make a hero out of this man, and I don't propose that the young shall be allowed to worship him as a hero. Probably not realizing they were pioneering a new genre, the frustrated motion picture men picked out a building that resembled the jail and filmed an actor who looked like Schrank emerging between two bogus deputy sheriffs. No discussion of assassination would be complete without exploring the precautions that can be taken to prevent these attacks. First, of course, just as with any danger, one must learn that a hazard exists. In the Bardo case, for example, there were many warnings. Over a 2-year period, he had sent Rebecca Schaefer a stream of inappropriate letters through her agents in New York and Los Angeles. When Bardo showed up at the studio where her show was taped, it was a studio security guard who told him which stage she was on. Bardo himself said, "It was way too easy." On one of his visits to the studio, he explained to the chief of security that he was in love with Rebecca Schaefer and had traveled from Arizona to see her. After telling Bardo the actress didn't want to see him, the security chief personally drove him back to the motel where he was staying. Unfortunately, even having seen, though perhaps not recognized, several obvious warning signs, the security chief didn't see to it that Rebecca Schaefer was informed about the lovesick man who had been pursuing her for 2 years and had just traveled hundreds of miles by bus to meet her. After the shooting, the security chief explained his meeting with Bardo to reporters. "I thought he was just lovesick. We get 100 in a year. People trying to get in, fans writing letters." To the security chief, it was a matter of handling some fan according to what he called standard procedure. But to Bardo, it was a powerful and emotional event. "Bardo, I had problems with the security at the studio and the feeling I had toward them. I just put it on Ms. Schaefer." "What was that feeling?" "It was anger, extreme anger, because they said, 'No, you can't come in. Get out of here. Get away from this place.' They said, 'She's not interested. She doesn't want to be bothered.' And I just felt that she was the one that I would discuss that with personally in an encounter."
"But she didn't say that, did she?"
"No, but I felt, I perceived that that's what she was like." The security chief's account continues. "Bardo was terribly insistent on being let in. Rebecca Schaefer was every other word. 'I gotta see her. I love her.' Something was definitely wrong mentally. There was something haywire going on, but I didn't perceive it as potentially violent." In an unanswered refrain often heard after preventable tragedies, the security chief added, "What more could I have done?" About 2 weeks after Rebecca Schaefer was killed, there was another much-publicized stalking incident that answers the question. It involved a would-be assailant I'll call Stephen Janoff. He had once pursued a client of mine, and though our evaluation determined he did not likely pose a hazard to our client, we were concerned that he might be dangerous to a co-star on our client's television show. We met with that actress and told her about the case. Police and studio security warned the pursuer off, assuming that would resolve the matter. It didn't, of course. About a year later, the actress was in rehearsing for a play. One day she saw a man outside the theater who caught her attention, and she couldn't shake the feeling that he might be the person we had warned her about, so she called us. After some inquiry, we confirmed to her that Stephen Janoff was indeed the man she had seen, and that he was there in pursuit of her. She and her representatives asked for and then exactly followed our recommendations. She stopped using the front entrance to the theater for her rehearsal visits. The box office was provided with Janoff's photo and some guidance on what to do if he showed up. She agreed to have a security person with her. And she applied several other strategies we designed to limit the likelihood of an unwanted encounter. For 5 days, Janoff stalked the actress, but because of her precautions, he was unable to encounter her. Janoff had purchased a ticket for the opening night of her play, though he wasn't patient enough to wait till then. One afternoon, he walked right up to the box office, where an employee recognized him and sent out a call to police. Janoff produced a handgun and demanded to see the actress. The employee, hoping the gun was not loaded, ran off. Janoff turned the gun on himself, announcing that he would pull the trigger unless the actress was brought to him. After a 4-hour standoff with police, he was taken into custody. Not only did it turn out that the gun was loaded, but Janoff had a collection of other firearms back at his hotel room.
Context of white supremacy. So we will pick up. We are in chapter 13 still. This is a lengthy chapter, so we'll finish the rest of it up. We have 10 pages or so left in chapter 13. We'll finish that one up as well as chapter 14 today, and we will have, I think, 2 more sessions. I could be in error, but seems like about 2 sessions before we get to the conclusion of the text. The number, if folks have thoughts, suggestions, questions on the book, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We have, as I said, about two sessions left. So if we want to start thinking about major conclusions that we will take away from the book, as I've said, it can be a little bit more challenging because there have been bits and pieces of this book that I thought were constructive, tips that you can use to keep yourself safe, especially in our relationship type situations with white people or non-white people. Also, the book is written by a suspected racist, and I feel like that has also come through the text in a myriad of ways. If folks were with us at the very beginning of the broadcast today and you heard the introduction with Mr. DeBecker, he's speaking in 1999. He talked about the Columbine shooting and how Mr. Harris, one of the white killers, he failed the test to join the military. And he said that you would think he would have been a great candidate to go overseas and kill brown people. I mean, you know, given what he did here in the stateside. If folks have any thoughts on that segment, I thought that was especially important given some of the commentary that I and others have shared as we have read. *61, if you have thoughts, questions you would like to share. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Good evening, Gus.
Greetings, Thomas, in New York.
I missed a little segment at the beginning, but yeah, it sounds like he was qualified to be Chris Kyle for sure. The book reading, I caught a Marsha Clark, O.J. Simpson reference yet again, called him a murderer. And he was talking about the Bartle and Schaefer case. He was, in my opinion, practicing deception. He said the guy he was interviewing, who I think was Bartle, was a sexual degenerate. He went through the whole story. He tried to get a prostitute. He responded to this actress sending him a reply to a letter he sent her. He hired a private investigator. He left one continent to another, zigzagged in his motion like he says serial killers do. He moved into her apartment, stalked her, and then killed her. But then he added to all of that he was going to go kill his client, but, you know, before he was going to go kill Schaefer. So I just don't see how this guy would be planning to kill someone else after he did all of that. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. He seemed to have a personal connection with her. Why would he add that he wanted to kill someone who had hired him to protect her And, of course, you know, he couldn't get to my client, so he went ahead with his first plan, which was, like, why would you even add that in there? It just doesn't make sense. He went there specifically to kill that lady because she replied to his letter. I wonder what his thoughts was on the Mike Tyson piece from that era. I don't think he mentioned that piece. I would say public figures get attacked within a hundredth of a percentile compared to quote-unquote regular people. So I just don't really get it. You know, I think that very rarely does a public figure get killed, and generally a rapper. How can anyone who studies murder and mass murders and things of that reference, you know, and have no comments of no references of white on black mass murders? I mean, August 20th is supposed to be, what white people say, is only the 400th year since we've been here. It's 400 years of continuous white on black murders, that serial murders. I mean, it's the way that they, if you go through the course of history, how the same murder keeps happening over and over again the same way. It just baffles me. Well, not baffles me. It just shows how much of a white supremacist he is, that he wouldn't have any references of these murders at all. It's all this, these high-profile white people doing what they regularly do, go kill a bunch of other people. You know, just you know, nonsense, in my opinion, compared to something that's happened and happened and happened. You could prove that it's a continuous thing happening. It's not like it stopped. I mean, you have a continuous serial killer, you know, on the loose, and he doesn't make any references to that. And I mute myself. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. I think I and others have commented on that throughout the book, that you're going to talk about all these different types of violence, and it's not even restricted to, like, just when I say types of violence, it's not like it's just restricted to relationship violence or stalkers or political assassinations or harassing of so-called famous figures. Like, he touches the whole gambit, all different types, workplace, the whole nine. If you're going to do all that, then certainly there should be at least one paragraph with, oh, yes, the Negros have been subjected to a lot of violence. Back to O.J. Simpson and Al Sharpton, that would have been all right. But to do all, we haven't read the whole thing. Maybe he has a section on the Negros in the last two chapters or so. I don't think that's going to happen. But, I mean, we've read, I think at this point, about 75-80% of the book. Haven't come, and I mean, that chapter should have been early. Like, as much terrorism against black people worldwide, that chapter should have been before we even got to O.J. Simpson, in my opinion. Wouldn't have Al Sharpton if it wasn't all this violence against black people. Other folks who dialed in, if you have hand up, questions, comments, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, my brother.
Greetings, Mr. Demery Four.
Yes, greetings, Gus, and greetings to Thomas in New York, the other callers and listeners. You know, that's a very good point that Thomas brought up, and I didn't get to hear all of his commentary because the call dropped, but I'm sure I was in agreement with everything that he brought up. What struck me first about this reading was, I guess, the Rebecca Schaefer, you know, how easily that Bardo was able to come in contact with her. And I was thinking, today, even if you were a relative of a celebrity, you would have a difficult time getting, you know, face-to-face with the person, you know, without an appointment or a prearranged some type of meeting. That's not, you know, that's one of the things that is definitely have changed about that. And The first things that jump out at you is this book is mostly dealing with white culture events, because you would almost, this thing about Ruth Stein hanging the shot Eddie Wonkus, you know what I mean? I don't get the point, really. I don't see any connection between someone that's mentally ill and they have some type of obsession with a celebrity. I don't see how you can validate that. But like in Robert Bardo, early in the book, he went back and talked about how Bardo was treated like a pet and a cat in the house and all that. He gives all these explanations as to why someone would commit an atrocity, but you don't see that same explanation when he's talking about, let's say, when he's mentioning O.J. Simpson. So I think too much time has been spent on, you know, validating or using these certain assassination attempts to validate his analysis. Who would bring up this guy? Let's see, what is his name? The one that shot George Wallace. I mean, Arthur Beamer, Bremer. That's kind of reaching. I mean, because at the time that George Wallace was shot, I know that at least a lot of black people didn't have a lot of sympathy for him at the time. And then probably wouldn't have that much disdain for Arthur Bremer. And as we, you know, he tried to tie all this together. But I think that when you are mentally ill, you can't make any sense out of that. You know, you may be able to go deep into their childhood and come up with some explanation, but yet and still, that doesn't explain it. And then, one last thing about the media, the way they describe the perpetrators or the mass killers, a lot of them, the one that was in the movie theater, he was smiling. He laid down his weapon, gave up, and was smiling when they took him in the custody. A lot of them, if you're white, you stand a chance. Even if you kill multiple people, you stand a chance of not being killed yourself by the police and being taken in. But if you're a black man, even suspected of some foul play, and not even a suspect, you could easily lose your life. And one last thing I wanted to talk about, if I could find it here.
Welcome back, Redskins' second preseason game.
I talked about that, but the way the media describes, you know, the genius of the. Oh, just one last thing. Ernest Becker observed that Nazism is universal. You know, I disagree with that. And I think one thing that is common with these racist suspects and even the author himself is that is a common trait among suspected racism is narcissism. And I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. We have certainly spent a good chunk of time on the context of white supremacy discussing narcissism, narcissistic personality disorder. Even some of our guests and even some of our previous books that, you know, have touched on this subject matter, Wisdom of Psychopaths as well. Excellent point. Even Dr. Welsing has that section in the ISIS papers where she talks about narcissism as it relates to collective white culture. Definitely a point to ponder on. Double check the switchboard. See if other folks, if you have questions, comments, *61, if you have thoughts to share on the text. Oh, let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everybody else. Yeah, to answer what I think was your question, I would say with the killers in and what was that, Colorado?
Columbine
High School.
Yeah, Columbine.
Columbine. Yeah. Yeah. It's possible they could have been killers of whoever the racist point towards to kill, even other white people. When the draft was still in action, and also with, let's say, Vietnam, they were lining up people who actually committed crimes and was sending them off to the military and to war, and in turn, and some of them were great killers, as far as that concerned. So that's reasonable as far as in an evil way, the possibilities. There's some people who just, you know, love to kill. I just wanted to speak on that. It was obvious to me, and maybe to some others, that he didn't speak of any non-white black victims of being assassinated. He didn't speak about Dr. King. The first blatant attempt of someone to try to kill him, I wouldn't call it assassination. From even white people would say that the person who stabbed him was a deranged, quote unquote, black female when he was, you know, signing a book. But he didn't mention anything about James Ray at all. Didn't mention about Malcolm X, Minister Malcolm X, and the consequences behind his assassination at all. I would say that it's probably deliberate of him avoiding those assassinations because he would have to enter in more of a racism and white supremacy objective into his expert analysis. All of these white killers is just want attention and that sort of thing. You know, so I think it was obvious, is all I'm saying. And those are just some of my thoughts on the first half reading. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I think that's an important point as well, which converges with kind of what I've been saying. I think some of our other listeners as well about it seems like a willful.
Is anybody else cut off? Can you hear me?
Yes, that's, we can't hear that.
Okay, well, that's I guess that's him alone that got cut off. He eventually would come back on. when he figures that he got cut off. But yeah, I was just thinking about that as I was listening to. I was just waiting to see if he was going to mention anything about any non-white black people and their demise by being assassinated. And I'm not surprised that he didn't bring up any, based on what I've heard him, how he's, the patterns on how he was writing in the past chapters. I'm not surprised by it. And I'm trying to come up in my mind on such thing as a quote unquote black assassin. Has anybody heard of that connection, that type of connection with a black person as being an assassin?
John Muhammad, Lee Malvo, Mark Essex.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
Well, Micah X. Johnson, and the dude yesterday, although he didn't succeed. You know,
the guy yesterday?
Yeah, Philadelphia, you could call him a
all right,
assassin.
Let's...
Yeah. Go ahead, Boston. Sorry.
Much obliged. Thank you, Dak. Did you all have another point on the book, The Philadelphia Assassin? We are going to make a point.
I did have another point on the book. I think that in his attempt to make it seem like these white people are seeking fame, I would say that in this era, because he wrote this book way before social media, in this era, you would have assassinations of these famous people left and right based off of the attention that they get from these stars who are able to actually tweet them back and Facebook them back and all of that stuff. So I just think that he's off on that based off of today's era where the artists or entertainers engage with their fans more personable than ever before. And I don't see them being killed like, you know, he's explaining it.
Interesting point, Thomas in New York. I was thinking about that as we've been reading the book, because this was published in 1997. So, I mean, it's slowly encroaching on 25 years since this book was published. Absolutely. With social media and all of the way that has revolutionized how people communicate, even so-called celebrities, famous people or what have you, where they can be online tweeting and direct messaging and all the rest of it all day. That absolutely has changed drastically the relation or the nature of that relationship between those folks and how much access you have to them, how much you can talk to them. And yeah, to his point, yeah, if it was something where it was making you feel like you're special and that sort of thing, my goodness, look all over, you know, the tweets and everything else, Instagrams. I guess I'll share a few. Or I guess even before I share a few. So chapter 13 was long. We didn't even read the whole thing. Chapter 14 is kind of long, too. So the second audio segment is a little longer than what it would normally be just because there is no spot. Like, I tried and tried and tried, and there is no clean spot to break it where we wouldn't have been just stopping on a random page as opposed to at the end of a chapter or at least at a break point in the chapter. So that is one. I think when I was when I lost my connection, I was saying I thought it was so important. Again, Mr. DeBecker deliberately, in my view, not addressing racism, white supremacy directly in it. And it stands out because there's so many instances here where he mentions people and or cases that are all about racism, white supremacy. That's the whole case. The whole book is almost about O.J. Simpson. How can you talk about that without talking about racism, white supremacy? He mentions George Wallace. It's hard to mention George Wallace without talking about white supremacy, racism, and talking about, oh my goodness, massive resistance, segregation in Alabama. What Mr. Demery before mentioned about, you know, probably a lot of black people not necessarily feeling bad, probably not going to need to take a day off work after they found out there was an assassination attempt on Mr. Wallace at that time. To have so many of these types of people and incidents mentioned, but there is no direct discussion of racism, white supremacy. I think that's
deliberate racism every time, white people being deceptive. Let's see. Next, with the, I had to start my whole page here, getting my notes back. Next, with the, he said about the way that assassins in particular are described. I see this consistently. Like I said, I even see it with him. That's why the audio segment that I played at the beginning, where he's talking about the Columbine shooters, where he says in a certain context, they're courageous. I hear that consistently when it is white killers. They will go to great lengths to talk about the mental exploits that the killer displayed in planning the attack and carrying it out and amassing the weapons and fooling people. He was really intelligent and used all that intelligence for the wrong thing. This happens as a matter of routine. I would say for me, it is unusual when it's the Willie Baskets, that's what we talked about last week, when it's somebody non-white, a black person. I don't hear when they're talking about O.J. Simpson. I don't hear that. I don't hear them talking about, oh, man, that Jew sure was cunning. He sure was clever. He used all those wits. He's not just an athlete now. Don't let that fool you. He used all his smarts. That's how he tricked Nicole Brown Simpson. She didn't know he was a no-count scoundrel. He tricked her. And then he tricked everybody. I don't hear that. They just talk about how he's a no-good lying coon and murder. That's all they do. They don't do that. They wait for the Dylan Roos. They wait for the Ted Kaczynski, as he said. They wait for them. And, oh, this is a bona fide genius. Oh, that's what they do for white people. Again, system of racism, white supremacy, which doesn't even get addressed in the text. Next. I forgot which person brought up that point about him. I think it was Thomas in New York, him making the self-reference when he was talking about Rebecca Schaefer and her white killer, Mr. Bardo, him saying, well, you know, Rebecca Schaefer, it's not like she had Gavin DeBecker or anything where he gets to slip in a little nice promo. Talk about narcissism. I think it was a great, great illustration. Thomas in New York, like, oh, yeah, he wasn't even going to attack her. He had done so much research and, you know, he had security and much less to have the premier security expert, Gavin DeBecker, founder of the Mosaic spreadsheet where you can go and get all the data information you need about your workplace attacker, domestic abuse attacker. And I would say that that's sort of self-aggrandizement. That's what I think that is. If we have other readers you disagree, you can speak up. I think that sort of self-aggrandizement, how important I am, what an expert I am, it is very common. I'd even say it's common within these type of books. For I classify this book in together with The Wisdom of Psychopaths, Kevin Dutton. We read that some time back. It feels very much the same. We're looking at these gruesome cases, trying to learn, try to stop these events from happening. I mean, very much the same. They could be on the same aisle if you had a category like this in the bookstore. But I see the same type of, I'm an expert at this subject matter in this field. Look at all my credentials. I've been all over the world. I've worked with all of these people studying. I see that not just, you know, with these two authors or with these books, but I see that with white people in general. I say that all the time. I think Mr. Fuller says that. That's one of the components of white supremacy, racism, to be able to brag. The only time I don't hear them doing that is when they say that they're ignorant about racism. Any other time, it's, you know, showing off all their credentials. Let's see. Next, I think someone said last week he had to get in one more jab at O.J. Simpson. So there's no way. There's too much text left. There will definitely be more jabs at O.J. Simpson, calling him a murderer again this week, even though he was acquitted. Let's see. I did think the patterns, that is something that we talk about on this program on a regular basis, looking at patterns that white people exhibit. That was something that Dr. Welsing talked about on a pretty regular basis. It's in the ISIS papers in terms of being able to recognize patterns so that you can see similarities in behavior, even precursors in behavior. I thought that was important. He gave out a list, even though he's talking about assassins and being able to see some of the same things, same behavior patterns, same ideas that they have in common. Obtaining a weapon. These are even some of the things. That's why I said with this book, I do think there might be some helpful tidbits, even though I certainly do not agree with everything and think he practiced racism. Might be a helpful tidbit here or there. the owning a weapon, talking about a weapon, that one keeps coming up consistently. Communicating inappropriately with some public figure, though not necessarily the one attacked, that one I think is important in a workplace context or anywhere else. When you see someone who has a pattern talking to someone in an aggressive, vile manner, saying incorrect things, if it's sexual or just violent or what have you, that is something to make a note of. That sort of behavior, this could happen again. If it's someone that you're first meeting and they're exhibiting those sort of behaviors, might want to be something that you make a note of. Let's see. Number 9 on that list, I thought, was white people extraordinary, had the ability to circumvent ordinary security. I'm not saying that non-white people never have this ability, but wow, the way that black people are subjected to overzealous search, molesting on a regular basis to do anything. I think white people have a much better time avoiding that scrutiny, security at all. We even get scrutinized trying to go to school. I just saw a report today. We were talking about that with young children. Anyway, I'm going to stop here. I'll double check to see if other folks have comments, questions they would like to share before we move off to audio segment number 2, even though it's a little early. Anything else stood out from the second or the first audio segment we read? Folks want to make sure they share how this book would sound a little different if it was written now or had been written in the last 5 years, with social media being what it is and the exchanges that happen so easily between so-called celebrities and quote-unquote ordinary people. Everybody satisfied? Grant. Is that Thomas in New York?
Mr. Jim? No, that's Mr. Henry Ford. I wanted to mention something. He made reference to a famous person. It was the convoluted irony of the media age where Marsha Clark prosecuted a regular citizen who stalked and killed a famous person, then prosecuted a famous person, O.J. Simpson, who stalked and killed a regular citizen, then became famous herself and is now the focus of a stalker. I thought that that was, you know, that's like a lot of confusion, because, like you said, another jab at O.J., but putting all that in there together, I don't see what point he was trying to make. And then the point about Evel Knievel, comparing Evel Knievel to Robert Bardo, I mean, that's a stretch, too. I can't see any similarity there. I'll mute my line on.
His attention analogy, that didn't do it for you? Both of them trying to get attention for these acts, that it has to be about the publicity, people seeing them do the jump, or people seeing the killing or attempted killing of a president or a figure, that didn't seem logical for you?
Not at all, because if Evel Knievel said that he was going to do something, build up the hype, he would at least attempt it, even if it wasn't in his mind to complete. He would try something. This guy, you know, I don't see how you could, you know, put a mentally disarranged person who just decides one day to make himself famous by shooting somebody famous in the category. I don't see it.
Right. I do encourage, watch those metaphors. I do say that on a regular basis, that frequently two separate entities will be contrasted and compared, and the person will submit, hey, these two things are very similar, if not equivalent. Study. See if that's accurate. I have found often the two things will not be equivalent. Second audio segment. Now, again, these chapters 13 and 14 specifically are a little longer. So we're still in 13. We'll get done with that one. We should get through with 14 as well. If you have additional comments, questions, make a note. We will have additional time once we are done with this chunk of Gavin DeBecker's The Gift of Fear, Survival Signals That Protect Us from Violence. I guess not black people, since that's not really being addressed in the book. Context of White Supremacy. This is audio segment number two.
The Janoff case shows the enormous improvements the entertainment industry has made to address the safety of media figures. Several theatrical agencies, movie studios, and management firms now routinely have inappropriate communications and visits professionally evaluated. Unlike in the Bardo case, media figures are now more likely to be informed of inappropriate pursuit. These and other improvements have brought clear results. Successful attacks against media figures have been sharply reduced in recent years. I wish I could say the same for professional sports, which brings to mind the murder attempt on the young tennis star Monica Seles. Though it certainly won't be the last attack on a sports figure, with a little effort, it could be the last one facilitated by negligence. Before I give you some little-known details about the Seles case, I want to discuss something about the hazards public figures face that is relevant to your safety. It is the myth that violence cannot be prevented. John Kennedy once made the point that assassins could not be stopped because all anyone has to do is be willing to trade his life for the president's. Kennedy's oft-quoted opinion is glib, but entirely wrong. In fact, assassination not only can be prevented, it is prevented far more often than it succeeds. Though assassins have a few advantages over their victims, there are many more factors working against them. Literally, thousands of opportunities exist for them to fail, and only one slender opportunity exists for them to succeed. It's not the type of crime a person can practice, both literally and figuratively. An assassin has one shot at success. Like John Kennedy, people who apply a fatalistic attitude to their own safety, e.g., burglary cannot be prevented, someone can always find a way in, often do so as an excuse not to take reasonable precautions. Yes, a committed criminal might well be difficult to stop, but the absence of precautions makes you vulnerable to the uncommitted criminal. In the Seles case, everybody knew that it made sense for her to have security at her public appearances in Europe. Because she was deeply enmeshed in the continent's greatest conflict, the Serbs versus the Croats, her public appearances frequently brought political demonstrations. She routinely had bodyguards at her tournaments, as she did at the 1993 Citizen Tournament in Germany. Nevertheless, soon after arriving on the court, one of history's most brilliant athletes lay on her back, bleeding from a serious injury. Though ostensibly protected by two bodyguards, she had fallen victim to a knife attack, the most preventable of all assassination methods. Why did the bodyguards fail and assailant Gunter Parke succeed? One of the two bodyguards, Manfred, answers my question in his statement to the police, but he begins with the wrong words. I am a telecommunications worker. I have a side job for the private guard firm at the tennis grounds. Presumably, a star tennis player could fairly have the expectation that the bodyguards assigned to her would in fact be bodyguards, professionals with some relevant training and experience. She might fairly expect that they would have at least discussed the possibility of a safety hazard, maybe even discussed what they would do should one present itself. But none of that happened, and the promoters did not tell her that the people they had assigned to guard her life were unqualified part-timers. She had to learn that when Gunter Parke plunged the knife into her back and then raised his arm to do it again. The second bodyguard's name is Henry, and his statement too begins with the wrong words. My main job is as a loader at Hamburg Harbor. I have a side job where I am in charge of security at the tennis grounds. At this tournament, my job was specifically to accompany and look after Monica Seles.
Amazingly, both men reported that they took special notice of assailant Gunter Parker prior to the stabbing. Henry pegged the attacker quite accurately. "Call it a sixth sense or whatever, I cannot explain it, but I noticed the man. Something told me that something was not quite right with this man. He was swaying instead of walking. I cannot explain it in more detail. I just had an uneasy feeling when I saw the man. As I said, I cannot explain it in more detail." Though he clearly had an intuition about the assailant, his main message appears to be that he cannot explain it. Rather than tell anyone about his concerns, Henry decided instead to put down a coffee cup, which he was holding in his hand even though he was on a protective detail for the most controversial figure in world tennis, and stroll over to do I don't know what, and he didn't know what. Of course, he had taken only a few steps by the time the attack had started and finished. It's perhaps not fair to criticize Henry and Manfred, for they know not what they do. That, however, is exactly my point. While Celis was recovering from the knife wound, tennis promoters set out to promote the idea that such attacks cannot be prevented. Here is promoter Jerry Diamond telling interviewers on CNN that screening for weapons with metal detectors would never work in tennis. "When you're working in an enclosed facility where you've got walls and a ceiling and a roof, yeah, all those things are possible. But a metal detector is not going to deter anyone who is determined to go in that direction." His statement that weapon screening can't work for tennis because some facilities lack walls and ceilings makes no sense. When I heard it, I was offended that someone would throw around life and death opinions with such misplaced confidence. Though he later called weapon screening ludicrous, Mr. Diamond has, throughout his career, managed to screen every single spectator for something far smaller than a weapon, a tiny piece of paper, the ticket he sold them. He doesn't know, I imagine, that most television shows now have metal detector screening for audiences. Why? Because if they didn't, some armed person with the intent of harming a TV star could get a ticket and get within immediate reach of his target, just like Robert Bardo did when he visited Rebecca Schaefer's TV show carrying a concealed knife, and just like Parker did at the Citizen Tournament. When you screen audience members, you don't have to worry about what is in people's heads because you know what is in their purses and pockets. Weapon screening is good enough for courthouses, airlines, TV shows, city halls, concerts, high schools, even the Super Bowl, no ceiling. But somehow, a businessman tells us it can't work for tennis. Of course, it's convenient to see it Mr. Diamond's way, because if attacks are unpreventable, then he and other promoters have no duty to try to prevent them. Questioned by reporters about security weaknesses in professional tennis, another spokesperson explained that since tournaments occur all over the world, security precautions cannot be standardized. Really? Everywhere in the world, they require that each tennis ball must bounce 135 to 147 centimeters when dropped from 2.5 meters. Everywhere in the world, the courts are required to be exactly 23.8 meters long and 8.2 meters wide, with service courts that extend exactly 6.4 meters from the net to the service line. This sounds like standardization to me. And yet they ask, how could you possibly have a standard credential and access control system in all those countries? Well, you just have to go to the trouble of implementing one. After the Celis attack, the Women's Tennis Council publicized that they'd enhanced security. Yet they didn't require promoters to take two obvious steps, the use of metal detectors for screening spectators and the installation of clear plastic audience barricades, like those at hockey games. Weak security improvements, including those you might make in your own life, are sometimes worse than doing nothing because they give false peace of mind and convince people that safety is being addressed when it is not. Poorly designed security fools everyone, except the attacker. When people hear about some public figure stalker,
They may think the case can be added to a list that consists of Chapman and Hinckley and those few others they recall. In fact, each is added to a far longer list. My office has managed more than 20,000 cases, and only a quarter of 1% have ever become public. Several individual clients of mine have received as many as 10,000 letters a week from members of the general public, some of which meet the criteria for review by our threat management staff. Death threats, stalking, bizarre demands, and persistent pursuit are all part of public life in America. Our work carries us to an underside of this culture that most people would not believe exists, but it does exist, just out of view, just below the surface. Here is a brief sampling of the kinds of cases we encountered in 1 2-year period. A woman wrote more than 6,000 death threats to a client because he was marrying the wrong person. A man sent a client of ours a dead coyote, which the sender had killed because it was beautiful, like you. A man sent several letters each day to the actress with whom he hoped to have a romantic relationship. 6 times a week, he walked miles to his local post office to see if a reply had arrived. Over 8 years, he had sent the actress more than 12,000 letters, one of which included a photo of him with the inscription, "Can you see the gun in this picture?" We were waiting for him when he showed up at her home. A man who was obsessed with becoming famous shaved off one eyebrow, half his head, and half his beard, then traveled cross-country in pursuit of a famous actor. He arrived in the actor's hometown and went directly to a sporting goods store where he priced a rifle and scope. He was arrested the night before our client made a major public appearance. When I interviewed the stalker, he told me that, "Whoever kills Caesar becomes a great man." A man sent a famous singer a picture of a heart pierced by a knife. 6 months later, he was at her gate to serenade her to kingdom come. And then there are those who committed terrible crimes against others, influenced by delusions involving some distant public figure. A man attacked a teenage girl with a knife because he thought she was the famous model he was obsessed with. A teenage girl killed her parents and said she was ordered to do it by a movie star. In one case that became very public, a man named Ralph Now had sinister delusions involving 4 different famous women, all clients of our office. He focused primarily on one whom he believed was an evil impostor. He killed a dog and sent the teeth to one of our clients. Later, he traveled more than 30,000 miles to destinations around the world in search of her. He knew where the impostor lived, but didn't go there. Once he attended a concert given by the impostor, unaware that all the seats around him were occupied by threat management agents. We investigated ways to get him incarcerated or hospitalized, but he went to work reliably and never broke the law. He worked at a veterinary clinic, so even the killing of the dog could not be proven to be criminal. We monitored him closely every day for 3 years, after which he returned to his family home. I notified his father that references in some of his 600 letters convinced us he would likely be dangerous to someone in his family. Within a few months, he had killed his 8-year-old half-brother with an axe. The boy was preventing him from watching something very important on television, a signal about my client that he felt was being sent to him, even though he confessed to the killing, now was acquitted on a technicality. Every few months, he's able to petition the court to release him from a mental hospital, and every few months, we stand ready to testify against him. Given the number of cases evaluated by our threat management office, a virtual assembly line of madness and danger, I have had to be mindful of the need to keep a human connection between protector and pursuer, for only then are predictions likely to be accurate. Members of my staff who work on assessments put together a profile on each case. At some point, we begin to refer to individuals under assessment as profiles. This became part of a growing terminology unique to our work, some of which I've shared with you in this book. For example,
Those people who believe they are the Messiah, Captain Kirk, or Marilyn Monroe are described as Dell ID cases for delusions of identity. Those who believe they are married to one of our clients are called Spouse Dell for spousal delusion. Those who feel they are acting under the direction of God or voices or devices installed in their brains are known as OutCon cases, short for outside control. I used to be concerned that this vernacular would dehumanize and depersonalize our assessments. But as we met more and more pursuers, came to know their lives more closely and understand their torment and the tragedy for their families, this concern evaporated. One can't help being profoundly affected by close involvement with people whose lives are a twisted chain of police encounters, hospitalization, relentless pursuit by imagined enemies, perceived betrayal by their loved ones, restlessness that moves them to new places, only to be restless there and move again, and above all, loneliness. No, there's no chance that my office will get too far from the human side of our assessment work. We can't forget the young man who broke out of a mental hospital, mailed a final letter to a distant public figure he loved, and then committed suicide. We can't forget those who killed others and somehow involved a media figure in their crime. Above all, we cannot and will not forget those who might try to harm our clients. In their search for attention and identity, most assassins go, as Park Dietz has put it, to the people who have the most identity to spare, famous people. Assassins know that when someone kills or attempts to kill a famous person in America, it is the grandest of all media events. A television reporter will stand with his camera crew just a few feet from another reporter standing with her camera crew, and invariably they will each call the crime a senseless act. But assassination is anything but senseless to the perpetrator, and those reporters are part of the sense it makes. The literally millions of dollars spent videotaping every single walk a president takes to and from a car or helicopter makes sense, too. Some call it the assassination watch. And electronic news organizations have obviously concluded that the cost of all those crews and all those satellite dish vans, all that equipment, and all that wasted videotape is worth the images they'll get if somebody starts firing a gun. Thus, television and the assassin have invested in the same crime, and every few years they together collect the profit from it. Remember Arthur Bremer, who set out to assassinate President Nixon but later settled on presidential candidate George Wallace? He weighed his act in terms that would make Nielsen proud. In his journal, which he always intended to publish after he became famous, Bremer worried about his ratings. If something big in NAM flares up, my attack won't get more than 3 minutes on network TV news. These senseless acts make perfect sense. Chapter 14. Extreme Hazards. In ourselves, our safety must be sought. By our own right hand, it must be wrought. William Wordsworth. All of us will encounter people in our lives who alarm us, or might pose some hazard. But as you've seen, a prominent public figure can have literally hundreds of people seeking unwanted encounters. I'm not talking about fans. I'm talking about people who feel they are under orders from God to harm a famous person, or who believe they are destined to marry a particular star, or who believe some media figure is being held hostage, and on and on. These cases have lessons any of us can benefit from. I want to present one that will demonstrate that even the most extreme safety hazards are manageable. This book has explored obsessions, death threats, stalking, mental illness, child abuse, multiple shootings, and children who kill their parents. Amazingly, there is one case that brings all these elements together,
a virtual hall of fame of American violence. At about 4 p.m. on July 20th, 1983, I was at a hotel in Los Angeles to meet with a client who was finishing a public appearance event. As I crossed the lobby, I was waved over by one of several people assigned to my client from my company's Protective Security Division, PSD. He told me about an important radio call from our office that he suggested I take in one of our cars. As always, I found the cars lined up, drivers at the ready, fully prepared for an unscheduled departure, our euphemism for an emergency. The report I received was an alarming one. It would clear my schedule for that day and for the 30 days that followed. Police in Jennings Parish, Louisiana, have discovered the bodies of five people brutally murdered. The lead suspect is Michael Perry. It was not the first time I'd heard that name. Michael Perry was among thousands of mentally ill pursuers my office had under assessment, but one of the very few we placed in the highest hazard category. The radio call was personal to me because the public figure Perry was obsessed with was not only a longtime client, she was also a dear friend. The client Perry was obsessed with is an internationally known recording artist and film actress. She already had a team of PSD agents who'd been assigned to her home for about a year. The precaution of full-time bodyguards had been undertaken in part because we predicted that Perry might show up, and in part because of another murderous stalker, Ralph Now. The radio crackled with bulletins between my office and the security personnel at my client's house in Malibu. Someone from our threat management division was already speaking with local police, and a meeting was scheduled for me at the FBI field office. Alarming reports are not uncommon for major media figures, but usually the more you learn about a situation, the less serious it turns out to be. The opposite happened in the Michael Perry case. He was an accomplished survivalist who had been in Los Angeles several times in pursuit of her. Perry's parents were among the homicide victims, and a high-powered rifle and at least two handguns were missing from their home. Perry had had more than enough time to reach Los Angeles. He had recently told a psychiatrist that my client was evil and should be killed. Before making that call, however, I was informed of one more detail that changed everything. Based on what I learned about a few words Perry had written on a sheet of paper found at the murder scene, I did something I'd never done before and haven't done since, even though clients have faced very serious hazards. I called my client and asked her to pack for a few days because I'd be there within a half hour to pick her up and take her to a hotel. Given what I now knew, I didn't feel we could adequately protect her at her home, even with a team of bodyguards. By the time I got to my client's neighborhood, the street had been closed by police and a sheriff's helicopter was buzzing loudly overhead. Within minutes, I was answering my client's anxious questions as we drove away from her home, followed closely by a PSD backup car. We'd be met at the hotel by two more PSD people. We would enter through a loading dock and be taken upstairs via a service elevator. A room near my client's suite was being modified to serve as a security command center. Two people from my office had already left Los Angeles bound for Louisiana. By the time they got to the murder scene the next morning, the bodies had been removed, but photos revealed a gruesome aspect of the homicides. Perry had shot out his parents' eyes with a shotgun. He had also killed an infant nephew in the same house and then broken into another house and killed two more people. In the living room of his parents' house, we saw that he'd fired several shotgun blasts into a wall heater. The damaged heater was a mystery we'd solve the next day, along with why he had shot out the eyes of his victims. But at that point, we were looking past these details in search of a single sheet of paper. Near where the bodies were found was a small pad printed up as a promotion for a local dry cleaner. On the top page was a collection of names, some crossed out, then rewritten, some intersected by lines that connected them to other names, some circled, some underlined, some in a column, others separated into groups of three or four. The names and lines were Perry's efforts to narrow down to 10 the number of people he intended to kill. Some were in Louisiana, one in Texas, one in Washington, D.C., and one in Malibu, the one that concerned me most. Little could any of these people have known that they were part of a bizarre contest between the enemies of Michael Perry. Little could they have known that in a small, dingy house in Louisiana, a man sitting with the bodies of three relatives he'd just shot was calmly and studiously weighing whether they would live or die. Perry wrote the word sky near the names of those he'd killed already, and he crossed out some others that didn't make his top 10. When he was done, my client's name remained. Now I had to find Michael Perry. His list not only brought us to the humid bayou, but started my excavation of Perry's history. In the weeks that followed, I would come to know his family and the people of Jennings Parish very well, come to know his schizophrenic sister, the doctors he'd told about his plan to kill people in groups of 10, the coroner, who would later FedEx us plaster casts of Perry's shoe prints from the murder scene, the neighbor boy who told us how Perry had decapitated his dog, the librarian who had lent Perry the books on survivalism that made him so hard to catch. I would soon know Michael Perry better than anyone else had ever wanted to know him. While people from my office began their second day in Louisiana, others quickly hustled my client from the hotel to a safe house we rented out of state. Others pursued leads in California, Nevada, Texas, Washington, D.C., New York, and even Africa. In Louisiana, Jennings Parish's small sheriff's department placed all three of its investigators on the Michael Perry case. My office added another 14 people to the search. Grace and Chester Perry had long ago predicted that their son would someday kill them. Whenever he was in town, his mother locked herself in the house, and he was rarely allowed in unless his father was home. They kept family guns hidden, paid Perry money to leave whenever he visited, and slept easier when he was off on one of his trips to California looking for my client. It's unclear exactly when he got angry enough to orphan himself, but it may have been at 7 years old, when, according to him, his mother pushed him against the wall heater in their home. Certainly the disfiguring and, to him, shameful burns on his legs daily reminded him of that incident. The shotgun blasts at the heater were a too little, too late revenge that had waited more than 20 years. As Michael Perry grew up, stories about him were always making the rounds, and neighbors had given up trying to figure out why he did the bizarre things he did. For example, he liked to be called by the nickname Crab, but then hired a lawyer to legally change his name to I. Everybody thought it was just another of his senseless ideas, but it did make sense. Michael Perry hadn't been the only 6-year-old whose father came home from work and questioned him about his various transgressions of the day, such as riding his bike in the street. He was, however, probably the only one whose father knew the details of each and every misdeed. Perry's father had been so uncannily accurate because a neighbor had agreed to watch the boy from her porch and then report his activities to Chester. His father told Michael, "When I go to work, I leave my eyes at home." Perry spent 28 years trying to hide from the scrutiny of those eyes. He even tried to symbolically become an eye. Then on July 19, 1983, he closed his father's eyes forever. The Perry house was built on foot-high stilts, and a child might predictably fear what was under there, as many fear what is beneath the bed. But unlike those of most children, Perry's fears were not soothed, and they grew into an elaborate delusion that dead bodies were rising from a chamber beneath the floor. With so much to occupy his pathology right at home, why did Perry's mind wander to a famous woman who lived 1,500 miles away? Why did he believe he would find his peace by killing her? I would know soon enough. There was another prominent woman on his list, Sandra Day O'Connor,
who'd just been appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Why did she get Perry's attention? Because no woman should be above a man, he later explained. He was used to powerful women. He'd been raised, as nearly all children are, by the most powerful woman in the world, his mother. Her power was misused, he felt, and his anger over it consumed him. Though the burns from the heater were long healed, Perry still wrapped his legs in ace bandages and never bared them in public. After returning from one of his stalking trips to Malibu, he beat his mother so badly that he was arrested and committed to a mental hospital. He quickly escaped and went right back to her house. Sheriff's deputies found him there, but his mother refused to let them take Perry back into custody. They persisted, but she resisted, and she prevailed. The next time deputies came to her home, the strong and domineering woman would be dead. Within a day of the murders, sociologist Walt Risler, a pioneering thinker in the field of predicting violence and a full-time consultant to our office for more than a decade, was on his way to Louisiana. There he interviewed family members, reviewed Perry's writings, and studied other evidence. Risler found the murder scene to be fertile ground for just the kind of madness deciphering he was so expert at. In a crib in the living room, Perry had piled an assortment of items. A crucifix, a pillow, three family photos face down, a wall plaque of the Virgin Mary, and a ceramic crab. This was a shrine of meaning to only Michael Perry until Risler began putting the pieces together. It was fair to assume that Perry was in one of three places or somewhere between them. Still in Louisiana in pursuit of local victims on his list, in Washington, D.C., stalking Sandra Day O'Connor, or in Malibu, likely in the thousands of acres of wilderness behind my client's home. Predicting that he might act out violently was simple. We'd done that even before the murders. The difficult questions to answer were how he would go about encountering his victims and how patient he would be. One late night, sitting in my office reviewing case material for the 100th time, I noted a report indicating that a book written by expert tracker Tom Brown was missing from the Jennings Parish Library. We knew that Perry had once checked out another book by Brown called The Search. Did Perry use the information in these books to escape detection while he lived secretly in the hills behind my client's home? Could he be just a few feet off a path as we walked obliviously by him? I knew whom to ask. Tom Brown had authored more than a dozen books on tracking and on nature, and he had been called in to search for dangerous men before. He wasn't anxious to do it again, but in our hour-long phone call, I convinced the wary and reluctant tracker to fly to Los Angeles and help us find Michael Perry. I picked him up at the airport, a wiry man with the quiet seriousness of Clint Eastwood. As I drove him to a waiting helicopter, he asked me questions about Perry. What kind of food does he like? Does he eat meat? Does he smoke? Tell me about his shoes. What kind of clothes does he wear? Tell me what his hair is like. Soon after arriving in Los Angeles, Brown was high above the Malibu hills surrounding my client's home, looking for any sign of Perry. Some firemen who had been shown a picture of Perry told us about a makeshift camp where they'd seen him some months before, and Tom overflew the area, pointing out spots the PSD agents then checked out on foot or horseback. When he searched on the ground, he was accompanied by armed PSD agents, and during the few days they spent together, he taught them some of what he knew about tracking. Brown was an absolute marvel. He could tell you where a person had walked, slept, even paused. His intuition was informed by a subtle and sometimes odd series of signals. Bent weeds, unsettled pebbles, shadows in the dust, and other details most people would look right past. Brown explained to me, when somebody moves something in your house, you notice it. When somebody moves something in the woods, I notice it. In a backpack, one of the PSD agents carried a plaster cast of a shoe print taken from the dirt outside the murder scene. Occasionally, Brown would ask to have it brought out, and he'd compare it to some small ridge or depression in the dust. One afternoon, after I dropped Brown back at his hotel for a brief rest, I was told by radio that a Malibu resident a mile or so from my client's home had reported that a strange man had knocked on the door and asked questions about the magic movie star. He had headed up the hill on foot. I sped back to my client's house, knowing I'd get there before someone who was walking. When I arrived, several sheriff's deputies had joined two PSD people. We waited for about 30 minutes, and then the dogs began barking and running up the side of a hill. Everyone followed the dogs, and soon we could clearly see a man crawling through the brush. Some sheriff's deputies ran around behind him, and a police helicopter descended on him from above. In a flash of everyone's adrenaline, the intruder was on the ground, handcuffed and scuffling. I rushed up the hill to identify him for the deputies, hoping the search for Michael Perry had just ended. He was lifted up and seated on the dirt, looking right at me, and I recognized him immediately. But he wasn't Michael Perry. He was Warren P., another mentally ill pursuer whom we had interviewed years before and heard from occasionally. He was a lovesick man who hoped to marry my client. Though worthy of assessment, Warren was without sinister intent. He was more of a tragic figure than a dangerous one. His bad luck had carried him through years of effort and across thousands of miles, finally getting him to my client's home, the mecca of his romantic delusions, but on the worst possible afternoon for a visit. As he was walked to one of the sheriff's cars, he just kept repeating, "I had no idea the security would be this tight." Late the next night, three PSD agents searching the area around my client's property using some of Tom Brown's techniques found a suspicious-looking trail. They took me there and shone their flashlights parallel to the ground, showing me the patterns in the dust. I confess I didn't see what they saw, but we all followed along, through a gully and into the dark brush. We were silent, hoping to find Perry and on some level hoping not to. Ahead of us, we saw what even I could tell was a shelter built of gathered wood and twigs. We moved toward it, and as we got closer, we could see that nobody was there. Inside, we found evidence that it was indeed the home of someone pursuing my client. Amid the filthy clothes, we found the sleeve of one of her record albums. There was also a fork, some matches, and a crude weapon called a bola, made from two rocks tied to the end of a length of rope. As we crawled out of the hut, we could see through a clearing directly to where my client drove by each day on her way to and from home. If Michael Perry lived here, he likely surveilled her from this spot. It didn't take long before we heard the sounds of someone moving toward us through the brush. In the moonlight, we held our breath and watched a man approach. He had a mess of dark hair, more than I thought Perry could have grown in the time he'd been at large. The man was wearing a crown on his head made of twigs and leaves. Pounced on from all sides, he yelled out, "I'm the king! I'm the king!" as he was handcuffed. It wasn't Perry, but still another mentally ill pursuer. This one was here to watch over my client, his queen. Those two obsessed men living in my client's orbit during the Perry case made clear just how menacing public life can be. The next time you see one of those frequent tabloid reports about some stars being stalked by a crazed fan, you'll know how silly the hype is. You could choose almost any star, almost any day, and that story would be true. All that makes it news is that a tabloid needed a headline. Just as we might come upon Michael Perry in Malibu at any moment, Walt Risler and our investigator might find him in the reeds along the marshy waterways around Jennings Parish. Or some lucky, or if not careful, unlucky state trooper might find him speeding in Chester Perry's Oldsmobile down the highway, or the U.S. Supreme Court police might find him wandering the halls of the historic building in search of Sandra Day O'Connor. Walt Risler, swimming deepest in the waters of Perry's delusions, concluded that Washington, D.C. and Malibu were a Perry-esque Sodom and Gomorrah. Weighing everything he'd learned about the case, Risler predicted
that Perry was on his way to the nation's capital to kill Justice O'Connor. Based on this, I made contact with a seasoned Washington, D.C. homicide investigator named Tom Kilcullen and filled him in on the case and Risler's opinion. Kilcullen was a creative thinker who followed up on several leads in the Washington area. Our efforts in Malibu continued with daily interviews of people who might have seen Perry. We asked local shopkeepers to keep us informed of anyone inquiring about my client, and we urged special attentiveness at the Malibu Library. That's because a search of Grace and Chester Perry's phone records had revealed that their son had called them collect from there a few times during one of his visits to California. Another call on those records was more chilling. 6 months earlier, there'd been a small newspaper report about my clients frequenting a particular Beverly Hills shop. The phone records revealed that Perry had called his parents from the phone booth right outside that shop. We were dealing with a capable stalker. To learn what Perry might know about his own manhunt, I reviewed newspaper stories about the case. Scanning USA Today during those weeks was interesting because I would come to a headline like, "Suspect in 5 murders, and it wouldn't be Perry. Mass killer still at large, it wouldn't be Perry. Man wanted for family slayings, and it wouldn't be Perry. Only in America." For 11 days, teams in different parts of the country looked for a man who hated to be looked at. Until July 31st, when Risler's prediction proved correct. Police in Washington, D.C. received a call from a sleazy hotel. A guest had reportedly stolen a radio from another guest. An officer was dispatched to question the two derelict oddballs who had been annoying each other, and he concluded that nothing illegal had happened. The minor dispute call would be over once the officer completed the routine step of checking each man for any arrest warrants. He asked them to wait a moment while the results of the computer search came over his radio. The unimportant matter became the most important of that officer's career because standing patiently in front of him was mass murderer Michael Perry. Within an hour, Detective Kilcullen called me and offered to let me talk to Perry, who was now in his custody. Just that quickly, the murderous stalker who had dominated my thoughts every moment for almost 2 weeks was on the other end of the phone, ready to chat. Without preparation, I stumbled into an interview with the nation's most wanted killer. We knew he'd been to my client's home, so I first asked him about that. He lied without hesitation, sounding like a fast-talking, streetwise con man. Perry: "I don't think I've ever been to her house, sir. I don't think so. I really don't." "Really?" "Right, I really don't." "Have you ever been to California at all?" "Well, I just went swimming at the beach, you know, and did some camping, that's all." Then, without my even asking, he told me how my client fit into his reasons for killing. Perry: "When she was in that movie, and whenever she turned around, she had quite a different face, you know. She looked like my mother back in 1961, you know? The face that my mother had. It was 1961. My mother walked into the room, and I was up way before anyone else, and my mother walked in, and she had this ugly-looking face, and I looked at this, and she turned her head and rubbed her shoulder. And that face in that movie reminded me of 1961. It ruined the whole thing, you know?" Perhaps he was recalling the day of the heater incident, burned into his memory as it was burned into his skin. He then quickly changed the subject and again denied ever having been to my client's home. It's common for criminals to avoid giving information someone wants, often precisely because it's wanted. But then he just gave up the lie and described the entrance to my client's home exactly. Perry: "You know, they had like a little drive-in theater deal," the gate intercom. "You know, you push the button and a red light," part of the security program. "And I had the impression that the house might have had an underground shelter, and it's a big place, and I rang the bell, and there was a camera out in front and everything. I didn't get that girl's attention, and she didn't get mine either. I just said, 'This can't be the place,' you know, due to respect, that this was such an ancient place. That's a strong, strong feeling." Perry became quiet. When he next spoke, it was about the nature of obsession itself. In his unsophisticated way, he described the inside of his experience as accurately as any psychiatrist could hope to. Perry, I really don't want to bring it up. It passed my mind. She kind of creeped up, and nothing had ever stuck to my mind like that. And even, you know, even today, he drifted off into silence, and I waited quietly for him to speak again. Perry, on her special on HBO, I saw her eyes change color. Her eyes change color a lot. What was that like? I didn't like it at all. That girl might be a witch, you know. She may do some damage to me if she hears me saying this. I'm saying what I saw. It did look like my mother. I don't want to mess with it because I know it was a relief whenever I forgot about it. I weighed the fact that she was a movie star, and realistically speaking, her address being in a magazine is not right. So I'm kind of scared of this girl if I met her. Of course, I don't know what it would be like. I know it's a touchy situation with this girl. I've stayed up many nights thinking about it. What if you had seen her at the house? I never did. And anyway, she has a boyfriend. But you know, she asked of me, and so I did, so that's about it. But I don't want to get too personal. I'm under arrest right now, I just want you to know that. They called the folks back home, and there's been some sort of big accident, some theft or something like that, which I didn't do. Perry got quiet again. It was clear that the man who tried to exorcise one of his demons by shooting his mother in the face still wasn't free of it. You don't like this whole subject, do you? No, I don't. The bad thing about it was that she turned around and had that ugly face. The face was completely different from the one she had had. I mean, it was a disaster that she looked like her. It was terrible, you know? And I turned off the TV and I left. I don't want to talk too much about it because, man, it took a lot of my time after I saw that. I said, this is too much. It took a lot of my time, and I didn't want it anymore. His voice drifted off, and then he hung up. I sat at my desk in disbelief. The emergency that had consumed nearly every hour of every person in my company had just ended, not with a stakeout or a gunfight or a SWAT team, but with a phone call. The man I had tried to know and understand through every means I could find had just told me outright why he had stalked my client and why he wanted to kill her. I walked into the TAM office, which was bustling with activity regarding the case, and said, I just got off the phone with Michael Perry. That didn't make sense to anybody, but it wasn't funny enough to be a joke. I flew to D.C. the next morning to learn anything of relevance to the case and to gain information that would help with the prosecution. Since our next job would be to help ensure that Perry was convicted, I'd been in regular touch with the Jennings Parish prosecutor, who was meeting me in D.C. When I arrived, Kilcullen told me Perry's car had been found and was being held at a nearby tow yard. We drove over together to look at it and see what evidence it held. Chester Perry's green Oldsmobile was dusty from its long drive. An officer looked in the window at the front seat and then recoiled a bit. It's covered in blood, he said. Sure enough, there was a dark, pulpy liquid sticking to the fabric upholstery. As we opened the door, I saw watermelon seeds on the floor. It wasn't blood on the seat. It was watermelon juice. Rather than pause to eat somewhere, Perry had bought a watermelon and eaten it with his right hand as he sped along the highway toward D.C. Perry had chosen to stay at a cheap little place called the Annex Hotel, which was about a mile and a half from the Supreme Court. When we went there, it became clear what he had spent most of his money on. He had turned room 136 into something that stunned us all. A bizarre museum of the media age, a work of pop art that connected violence and madness and television. Into that tiny room, Perry had crammed 9 television sets, all plugged in, all tuned to static. On one, he had scrawled the words, "My body," in red marker.
several of the sets had giant eyes drawn on the screens. One had my client's name written boldly along the side. The Louisiana detective in charge of the Perry homicides, Irwin Trahan, came to D.C. to transport Perry back home for trial. Often such prisoners are flown on commercial planes or on Con Air, the nickname for the U.S. Marshals' jet fleet. But Trahan and his partner had decided to drive Perry back to Louisiana. This unusual trio sped along the same highways Perry had driven to get to D.C., checking into motels along the way. The detectives took turns staying awake to watch Perry, who didn't sleep at all. At the close of their two-day trip, Perry asked them to pass a message to me. It was about my client. "You better keep an eye on her 24 hours a day." In an irony I wouldn't recognize for many years, Perry also told the detectives that if his case ever went before the U.S. Supreme Court and Judge Sandra Day O'Connor, "I wouldn't have a chance then because that's a woman." His case did eventually go before the Supreme Court. A while after Perry was back in Louisiana, we arranged for Walt Risler to interview him in jail to follow up on his sinister warnings about my client. An agitated Perry explained to him, "Tell her to stay away from Greece. That's all I want to say to you now, man. I'm feeling sick, so sick, my head is just filled with vomit." To keep the interview from ending, Risler asked about one of Perry's favorite topics, television. Perry responded, "Man, TV is really fucked up lately. I don't know what it means. After a while, it got so that the only sense I could make of television was by watching channels with nothing on. I could read them and make more sense than what was happening on the programs." He then asked his attorney to leave so he could speak with Risler in private. He took Risler's hands in his and explained that if he didn't get out of jail, there would be hell to pay. If he was executed, it would trigger the explosion of an atomic missile hidden in the swamps near town. "So you see, getting me out of here is important to everyone. I'm just trying to save lives." Perry stood up to end the interview. "Oh man, my head is filled with vomit. You can just see how fucked up my head is, can't you, from the things I think?" Perry was not faking insanity. This was the real thing. When I got back to Los Angeles, there was a kind letter from Justice O'Connor thanking me for my help and lamenting the fact that there are people in this country who are sufficiently unstable to constitute genuine threats to others. A few years later, after the Supreme Court adopted the Mosaic program I designed, I met with Justice O'Connor in her office. Michael Perry, by then convicted of the 5 murders and sentenced to death, had come back into her life in an interesting way. Prison officials ordered doctors to give Perry medication so that he would be lucid enough to know what was happening on the day he was executed. The doctors refused, reasoning that since the medication was being given just so he could be killed, it was not in their patient's best interest. The matter went all the way to the Supreme Court, and in one of history's most impartial decisions, the justices ruled that the murderer who had stalked one of them could not be forced to take the medication just to be executed. Michael Perry is alive today because of that ruling. The Perry case shows that even the most public of crimes are motivated by the most personal issues. Though the odds are overwhelming that you'll ever appear on the death list of some mass killer, I've discussed the case here to add to your understanding of violence and to reveal the human truth in the sensational stories we see in the news. Reports of such murders on TV, presented in one dimension, without perspective, and without the kind of detail you've just read, usually do little more than add unwarranted fear to people's lives. And people hardly need more of that.
The gift of fear. We are almost done. If you have comments, questions on what we read today, the number again, 615-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. He mentioned that Mosaic program again. Star 6-1, if you have comments, questions, if you did not get to share at all way back after we finished the first audio segment, you should definitely get your hand up now. Do not wait until the last 5 minutes if you think you have a question, comment, something that you would like to share before we wrap up today. Star 6-1, I'll look out for folks that we've missed totally. As we get to the line, all the other folks who dialed in with a hand up, Mr. Demery Ford, Thomas in New York, retired firefighter, all the rest of folks, if you have comments, questions to share, line should be open. Proceed. Any notes on the second chapter? Anything stand out? While folks get their thoughts together. Yes. Oh, let's see. Mr. Demery Ford, yes, sir.
well, at first, the bit about Monica Sellers. I'm trying to, get the facts out of this, but, I guess what he was trying to say was that after, she was attacked, and then what the people responsible for security were saying, that there was no way that that could have been prevented. And then, I guess in his brilliance, he goes along and shows how if it was a stabbing, it could have easily been prevented. And that now those metal detectors are like, commonplace. But people have ways to get past those metal detectors also. And even one guy was mentioned, he worked for US Air. I guess it was the black employee, David, I forget his last name. Anyway, he had credentials that got him past the metal detectors. That's just, something that I could really identify with, because it seems like I can remember, that incident, but I didn't get a chance to look it up too much. And it looks like that he spent a lot of time with this Perry guy, and out of all the things that he described, that proved that he was insane, it seems like it wasn't, that textbook. It wasn't an open and shut type insanity plea. It didn't convince me, at least. I don't know. I guess he was insane because of the bizarre things that he said, but still, that's what people try. If all else fails, you've killed somebody, you need an insanity plea, or you were abused, or it was self-defense. So I'll just leave my line on that. Thanks, sir.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Ford. This is so, we have at least one or two sessions left, but there's only one chapter left in the book. He has different appendixes that go over different information. So there's only one chapter left in the book, but we might have two more weeks left. That's the book, Gavin DeBecker. Much obliged, Mr. Demery Ford. I can't say that I remember any of the details about the Monica Sellers incident. That was so long ago, and I was a younger person then. I wasn't really paying attention as much. I'd have to go back to look at some of the details on that one as well. Other folks dialed in, comments, questions.
Have you heard?
Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
Good evening, Dustin Gaines. Yeah, Monica Sellers, that was a big one. I was so happy he didn't get into Nancy Kerrigan after that, because those two usually go together. But that might be before your time, guys. I don't know. All the talk about Perry, he said it was 2 weeks out of his life. You know, but what I'm seeing a pattern is on these white killers, who are, you know, straight up, I won't say they're insane, I'm just saying that they don't have all the chemicals working straight, have gotten away with this behavior over and over again before they actually do anything. Perry decapitated his dog. You find out they all had some type of crazy past, some type of traumatic childhood, beat their mama, leave manifestos, have kill and rape lists. In high school, you see the pattern, but it gets overlooked because they're white. You know, black kid arrested in class because he had too many pencils. You know, it's the total opposite. We are always under surveillance and scrutiny, and they just tend to get away, and these behaviors never get checked. And they always protect the parents when these things happen to these people. It's the same pattern. And, you know, Perry's parents, I mean, they abused him. That's why he did what he did. I mean, they buried him with radiators. Like, they make it seem like the parents were good parents. But, you know, they just had this day when they pushed him into a radiator or something. Nah. You know, you don't get to that point without traumatic, creating other personalities when you're in those traumatic states and things like that. So I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. I think that's been, at least for me, another pattern in this book that holds just with my view on whites, the system of white supremacy in general. White people are not ignorant about racism, and when they have these incidents, that's been one of the main points he's made in the book. These incidents, whether it's El Paso, whether it's Dayton, Ohio, or any other, Dylan Roof, any of these, pick any of them at random, Michael Perry, pick any incident. That these are not random acts, that if you have enough information, you know enough about this person, their family history, they're like, oh, yeah, as Dr. Welsing said, you'll connect all the dots. You'll see everything leading up to this moment. So I said, white people are not ignorant about racism. They know these individuals, whether they're going out and decapitating dogs, the family pet, the neighbor's dog or cat or whatever it is, how they've harassed and brutalized other children in the neighborhood or what have you, whether they were subject to abuse, they know all of this. It's not like, oh, wow, we didn't know any of this information. Really? All this was going on? That generally is not the case. That's what he said repeatedly. Mr. DeBecker, that's what he said repeatedly in this book. White people are not ignorant about racism. They're not ignorant about the terrorist violence of other white people. Jeffrey Epstein, I'm sure his white homies, they were not ignorant about what he was up to either. Other folks who dialed in, comments, questions? Thoughts on how this book would sound a little different if it was written in the last 5 years. Let's see. Get out a few of my comments as we're going. If other folks, we are almost at the end, so if you have a comment, question, speak up. Don't wait till the last five. When he was talking about the Monica Sellers stabbing and saying, really, he was saying that they needed to refine, improve their security code for the Women's Professional Tennis Association as a result of this. And I need to double check. I had not yet really given it any consideration until we were reading this. I can't imagine in 2019 that they don't have security screening, like metal detectors and, you know, patting you down. I can't imagine that. Given everything that's happened, being post 9/11 and everything now, I can't imagine them saying, yeah, we don't check. I don't. If we have anybody who's been to a WTA event, I know some of our Cows listeners have been to Wimbledon and got to see the Williams sisters. So if anybody's listening and you've been since this book was published, I would think they have got that implemented now. And even beyond all of that, I thought it was important because Mr. DeBecker, in pointing out the absurdity of the response from WTA officials and saying, oh, it's ludicrous to think that we're going to have metal detectors or plastic screen of some sort, to have some really draconian security measures as a result of this incident, where he points out, hey, you do all kinds of screening. You screen people for tickets all over the world, and you figure out a system to be able to do that. And he went through and began pointing out, when they do television audiences, they screen people. There is a process. There is a code where you can make this happen if you want to. And at least in my view, white people come out and make excuses like this frequently when they have the ability to do something and they just don't want to do it for whatever the reason is. They have extraordinary ability. We see that all the time. Let's see. Next, when Mr. DeBecker, when he was talking about Mr. Perry, this client is basically, I guess, the whole subject of Chapter 4. He says, we monitor him closely every day for 3 years. 3 years. The resources, like, I don't know anybody here, if you have hired other people or if you yourself took 3 months, 3 days to watch somebody intensely. But having the resources to study and watch someone for 3 years, that is power. That's what we're dealing with. And that even reminded me of the COINTELPRO operations, where you had individuals like Dr. Huey P. Newton. Again, none of this gets mentioned in the book, talk about assassinations. Dr. Huey P. Newton died from an assassination. Bobby Seale, many other members of the Black Panther Party, specifically in COINTELPRO, they said the same thing, that, wow, these folks could hire people and have folks sit around and study us all day long, day after day, year after year, and gather all types of information about your habits, psychologies, what do you like to do, what do you like to eat, what do you like to read, and have all kinds of profiles just about you. Racist man, racist woman, study everything, everyone. Let's see, next. He went through a lot of the codification with his team. It sounds like he has a lot of people working for him, and they have a very elaborate codification system. He was talking about the different ways that they identify cases, delusions of identity, delusions. The one was spouse delusions. If you're with somebody, it sounds like they have a very intricate code for doing all of this work. I'm sure it is super expensive. I'm sure he billed Bill Cosby an astronomical fee. I believe it was 1998 when he worked on the Ennis Cosby case. Let's see. Mm-mm-mm. Chapter 14 focused, as I said, mostly on Mr. Perry and him stalking his client, what they try to do to intervene. It seems like there are a lot of white people engaged in these behaviors. Again, I'm not saying that non-white people do not harm or stalk or any of that. Just seems like a lot of white people. I think he had that list I mentioned after the first audio segment, being able to get by security. It just seems like white people have a much easier time being able to go to these spots if they're going to do some stalking and that sort of thing than a black person would. If anyone thinks that that is not the case, system of white supremacy, speak up loud and clear as we have time left in the program. I just don't think you would be allowed, particularly if we're talking about white women, because he's, you know, Monica Seles and Sandra Day O'Connor. I just don't think that you would, that they would allow a black female or a black male these types of liberties with what you say, what you're doing. You're kind of hanging out close to this person so you could surveil them. I just think it would be substantially more difficult. Can folks think any famous cases, black person stalking someone white? I was trying to think, peruse as all this was happening, a black person stalking a white person. An immediate illustration is not coming to mind. I was thinking of some of the, like, Nat King Cole and some of the nonsense that he had to endure during his time. I'm not immediately being able to think of a white person being stalked by a black person. They caused him a real nuisance, a famous person, even a not so famous person.
By them being non-white black in the first place, they're already considered to be a suspect. And white people don't automatically suspect other white people. it's a trained habit between the two equations, I think, if that makes any sense to you.
Absolutely. They have enough illustrations of black people having a difficult time just existing, period, moving through public space, much less moving through public space, making it seem as though you are too attentive to a white person that you shouldn't be around, a white person that you have no business watching or keeping tabs on. That is for sure suspicious in an environment where black people are already suspicious.
I mean, in a lot of cases, a black person is even a suspect to another black person, from the way that the system of racism and white supremacy have retarded our thinking process and our self-respect with ourselves and each other. That is a prevailing thing that we even have suspicion big time with each other in a lot of cases, truth be told.
I would agree, unfortunately. If folks think of anything else with the stalking situation, feel free to share, or if you had other comments, what we heard from his tracking of, I guess, Michael Perry, and apparently these other stalkers who they found along the way in trying to obtain Mr. Perry. I was trying to read information about his case either, because I hadn't heard about Mr. Perry's case either. I wouldn't say I would agree. The system of white supremacy does demand violence, but when he was reading, he said he scanned USA Today during those 2 weeks. Was interesting because I would come to a headline like suspect in five murders and it wouldn't be Perry, mass killer still at large, and it wouldn't be Perry, man wanted for family slayings, and it wouldn't be Perry. Only in America, I would just rotate that to only in a system of racism, white supremacy, which again demands violence. We are reading this book at this time where they're talking about El Paso, Dayton on a regular basis, Philadelphia. They had the Norway shoe, you just keep adding. But I mean, that is the system of racism, white supremacy. You know, you just fill in new shooter, how many deaths, how many injured. That's the whole system. And again, back to the same point that I've made the whole time, to have that be the case and for that to not be the context of this book when so many of the events that he talks about are rooted in racism, call it what it is. Anything else folks want to make sure they get in?
For me, that Perry case just reminds me of a movie. I don't know if the Hannibal Lecter or if it's the movie Seven, those two movies, but the way the guy went back and killed his family. I wonder if this guy had something to do with one of those movies, writing or consulting. The Monica Sellers. So my wife is from Queens. Actually, she's from Flushing. So Arthur Ashe Stadium is in Flushing. It's out there where the Mets play. And she always typically gets the call for the U.S. Open and to work, you know, that couple of weeks that they have the U.S. Open. So I just asked her, like, you know, what's the security like when you work there? And she said it's no metal detectors. Hmm. All the security are mostly black people. So I had that long bells right away. Something happens, the niggas. She said, She said, the white people just walk around freely, could go up, touch the players, shake their hands, ask for autographs. They buy these big $200 basketball-sized tennis balls to get all the people to sign it. And, you know, it's real open for them to have contact with the players. She was actually quite surprised. And then, you know, it cross-referenced that to Kyle Lowry getting punched on the sideline by the owner of the team, you know, of the other team, just totally different. But, you know, that's not a violent Ron Artest getting assaulted by a fan. I mean, it's violence against the black players, you know, but they don't want to mention that. But I remember the Monica Sellers thing. I remember being very young, and she was laying there, and everyone felt so bad for her. And it happened in Europe, so it was mostly the British press talking about it. It was like a big deal. You know, white people have access, like firefighter said, we are suspect automatically. I worked in Kids of Us when I was 16, and this lady came in all the time with her son, white lady. Never was asked to watch her. As soon as certain black people came in, you know, Thomas called back off and said, this person watched them, you know, go ask them for help. You know, one day they came out and tackled the white lady. I said, oh, shoot, all this time she's been coming in there stealing, you know, little things, but, you know, no one really suspected it because she was white. You know, it was still, she's a white person, you know, just how it goes.
That indeed is the system of racism. Great point talking about Mr. Artest and Kyle Lowry, NBA champion, being assaulted on the sideline. I don't think anybody was prosecuted on that one either. I didn't hear anything about changes to security protocol at the NBA games. Keep players safe, even though they're threatened on a regular basis. That was a big topic of discussion on this past season. Any other comments, questions, folks want to make sure they get in, do so now. We're almost at the conclusion of the broadcast. Let's see.
And the black athletes get admonished when they a defendant fails and or go on the attack from getting assaulted.
Absolutely.
Whereas I can recall there was a NFL, he became an NFL Hall of Famer by the name of Mike Curtis, white male, ran onto the football field and picked up the ball during the game, and Mike Curtis just ran across him like he was had on full pads and just knocked him unconscious, you know, on the ground. And you know, nothing really was said about it, you know, too tough. You know, as far as that concerned, I mean, literally, if you look up Mike Curtis hits fan, you can see what I'm talking about. It took place in somewhere like in 1970s, that sort of thing. But it doesn't matter with time, because if a black person would have done that to a fan under any circumstances, he would have got some kind of admonishment also.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. That security point, I'm somewhat surprised in a post nine, and particularly in New York post 9/11, where they have a major tennis, the U.S. Open is major. They watch that all over the world, and, you know, press from all over the world is there to cover that. If that's one of the majors, as they call it in professional tennis, to still, not have more advanced, security. And to have such easy access to players who, you know, are worth millions of dollars. That is startling. Or I guess I can only assume it must be a really, really, or they are expecting this to be a super white dominated environment where we don't want them to in any way feel inhibited from being here. We've got the Negro security, as he said, but still here. Have a blast.
He said they do check bags when you enter. And it is extremely expensive to get tickets. So we've been priced out. You know what I'm saying? You're paying rent to go see the tennis match, especially if it's like Serena or somebody like that. You know, you got to pay. You know, it's New York, you know. So they priced us out. You know, you're lucky if you get to do the security there. But when she said that the security is mostly black. So it seems to me like probably one of these private companies that do like the office buildings, and it's mostly Africans, you know what I'm saying? But I could see if anything goes wrong, you're going to be the blame, you know, like, hey, the black, you know, look at the security they hired, you know, like, you know, they already have an out.
Check their green cards. Might have been hired illegally. Have to go through and make sure they can all be here legally. Could easily see that one.
The pricing out is actually is the one of the means of security, is to be able to screen, because they know they're going to lessen the amount of non-white people to get into sporting events
and also concerts, even rap concerts, from what I've recently heard. You know, I'm dealing with a 23-year-old under the same roof, and he was telling me that it costs $300, $400 to go see one of these people. And, I mean, that's going to screen a whole lot of non-white people from going to concerts or going to a tennis match, let alone talking about the Super Bowl also. You know, I mean, you're going to watch it on TV. I guess that's why Mr. Jay-Z would still be useful, but it's not that many black people that go to those games with that kind of money.
That is absolutely true. I guess I have never been to any of the Super Bowls. I have never been to the NBA
Me
finals.
Neither.
It seems like they have substantially tighter security at those events than what he was talking about at the tennis matches. I don't know if it's like that at all the competitions or if the U.S. Open is just like that. But I mean, wow, that is amazing. But again, system of racism. I guess maybe we can compare golf too, because they've had some of those issues where to see what the security is like. I'll maybe take a gander at that before we get back for next week. Anywho, did we get anybody? Anybody else have questions, thoughts, anything they wanted to share before we wrap up?
I wanted to say one last thing. I think you mentioned the amount of stalkers, you know, in the white culture, because when he was looking for this Michael Perry guy, you know, that was stalking his client, he ran across two or three other mentally deranged people that, you know, had some types of interest in the client. So it just brings up a question. Did he inform his client of the other people that were surrounding her grounds or that had an intent to do her harm? And then if that would qualify as warranted fear or unwarranted fear? I'll mute my line on that.
Good point. Just from what we've read, it would seem like that would definitely be information to share, that we haven't yet caught this Michael Perry guy. And in addition to not catching him, it seems like there were two other fellows who might have been out stalking as well. So definitely make sure you've checked all of your alarms and upgraded your security system. Danger is out there. But I mean, again, that is the system of racism, white supremacy. And if I was to make my own comparison, it might not be manifest in that form, where you have people hiding out in your bushes, shrubbery around your vehicle, where you work or where you live. But the system of racism, white supremacy, that is what it is, basically. You do have individuals who are sitting around plotting, scheming, planning to harm you in some way, shape, form. That is the system of racism, and that is one of the motivating reasons for why we are reading this book, because that is our reality. You might not be a celebrity or a famous politician on the Supreme Court or anything like that. However, just being classified as non-white, you are supposed to be mistreated. So be alert, be thinking. I think that's one of the main signals he's had from the book, in terms of just being alert and respecting those signals when you feel like, hey, something is not right about this situation. Let me get more details and not minimize that. With that said, I thought we might have ended it today, but not the case at all. And it looks like we probably won't end it next week either, even though there's only one more chapter left technically in the book. But we are close. Should be maybe 2 weeks and then we'll be all done. If you have suggestions for the next book, as I said, I think we should read Tar Baby. Toni Morrison, she just transitioned last week. I've not read Tar Baby, and it was suggested by a listener before, so I think that would be right and exact. But if folks have other suggestions, you can drop those in. 2 weeks, we should be moving on to something new. We'll be here tomorrow for Neutralizing Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Dial in. We'll be talking about suggestions for resume tips and
some of Gus's own difficulties trying to help other non-white people out in their chosen career field. That can be difficult, especially if it's going to involve white people trying to help out these non-white people do things. But that'll be tomorrow for Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The details have been posted on my blog. I emailed out folks who contacted me saying they wanted information about the December Cows, Florida Yoga Retreat. You can check the blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Drop me an email and I can send you more information if you are interested. Persevere through the holidays, and we will do it up counter-racist style with vegan treats in Florida for the new year. That said, much obliged for everyone participating and or listening in. I hope it was worthy of your Thursday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. You do not want to be intoxicated where you cannot think at your best and then find out, oh, man, I do have some of these issues happening. Maybe, again, nobody is camped out under my porch per se. However, I am being mistreated. And or these people were plotting to mistreat me. I couldn't think. I couldn't see it correctly. Couldn't prepare because I was under the influence. Let's make sure our brain computer is working at maximum capacity at all times so that we can go about the business of solving the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no, and that includes being off the cell phone if you are behind the wheel. Everything we can to keep ourselves as safe as possible. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.